Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Serena Williams, Wimbledon champion for a sixth time. All the big trophies and the big titles in her hands at once.
And we're joined today by Karen Phillips, New York Daily News columnist. You know, we're going to talk Serena today, and he wrote a tremendous article on July 6th about Serena Williams and the U.S. ADA testing her, you know, for steroids more than any other tennis player, male or female. So we're going to get into that. Obviously, Serena is in the Wimbledon semifinals, and she plays tomorrow. So she's looking for her what number Wimbledon is that? I think seven or eight. Her seventh or eighth Wimbledon title.
It's like 94.
So, exactly. So, exactly. Something like that.
Hey, well, Karin, welcome to the show, man. Thanks again for being on board. You've been setting people on fire, man. We told ESPN wasn't black enough.
Uh-oh.
And, just one after the other, man. Well, let me ask you something, man. So why this thing with Serena's been – people been talking about this stuff for years. It's unsubstantiated. What prompted you to write this particular piece talking about Serena being tested probably more than any tennis player on the circuit?
Well, like, the weekend before I wrote it, like, I saw there was a smaller piece written about that she had been, you know, tested this many times. So then I followed up and reached out to USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, on my own to speak with them about it. But I wanted to bring some context in and speak to the larger issue. And, of course, you can't deny or you can't ignore the fact that race could be a possibility here. But I'm someone who pays attention to the little things because I know that sometimes those little things matter. I'm a person that really believes in that details matter. And something about this just seems off when you can go to the database yourself and just go to the URL and go to the website and type in someone's name and see that she's been tested five times. Mm. But when you type in all these other people's names, it's nowhere near that many times. And you're just thinking, okay, like I understand people have had beef with Serena because of what Serena is. She is the antithesis of what we've been taught a woman's tennis player is supposed to look like, play like, and carry themselves. But it gets to a certain point that, look, let's just be honest. We're talking about the greatest tennis player of all time, male or female, and that's never failed a drug test for doping or anything else like this. And if she's being tested five times this year and no one else has. Now, when the original story, how this became a story, because USADA had showed up to her house unannounced, which they tend to do, to test her for the sixth time, but she wasn't there, and she got on the phone with them, and then this got out, and this became another story. So if she would have been at home, it would have been six.
Right.
Now, they have the rest of the year, I guess, to kind of catch up with everybody else, but if she's at six in July, like, you can do the math on how many times, and this happened back in June. So that, and she tweeted about it, as well as I also put a column back in May. So she's been dealing with this all through 2018. And at some point, I was just like, okay, something's either they don't believe her, tennis has some secret doping scandal going on that they don't want to get out, that they're scared about, or is this something that we kind of know was really going on behind the scenes? Because previously, like a month back, I wrote about this fake rivalry that the media, I hate saying that term, being in the media, but the media has created with this, with Maria Sharapova, and I was basically saying, like, look, there is no rivalry when you beat someone 18 straight times. Like, that's right. Not a rivalry.
And she's the one, the irony of that is that Sharapova was the one who got busted.
Right.
I mean, that was...
Exactly.
I mean, that's what's so ironic about this.
There's layers to it. And when, like I said, you look at Sloane Stephens and Venus, right. They've been tested a couple times.
Right.
But you throw in some of the white players and look up their names of tennis players, and you don't see that they've been tested yet. That's when you kind of be like, oh, what's going on here?
I'm trying to figure out why would they go after, you know, their own star, their own biggest draw? You know, like, is it just she looks big? Is it like they have the same stereotypical prejudice as everybody else?
Look, in my mind, it's either they don't like her, something's going on, or just because someone's the face of your sport and they're the biggest name in your sport, that doesn't mean you want them to be that.
Hmm. Right.
Those are questions I can't answer. They'll have to answer them, and who knows if we'll ever get the real answers about that.
Well, nobody admits that they're racist,
right.
You know,
exactly.
When everybody is.
Except Bob McNair.
Yeah, but at least he's honest. I mean, I think just about everybody in this country is either a racist or a recovering racist. And I think you're more honest if you say, listen, just like you're a sexist or you're a recovering sexist.
Right.
But to say that this insidious disease, which has infected this country for 400 years, but you know, like our white liberal friend, you are untouched by it. It's much more honest with your McNair, where say, you know what? I'm probably going to say some racist stuff, but I'm trying to recover, you know?
Right.
And, you know, the same thing with Venus or Barry Bonds or Michael Vick. Just go down the line in that there's just this knee-jerk reaction about attacking black folks who climb the mountain. It's just a knee-jerk reaction in our psyche.
Right.
And they can't explain it.
Right.
If I don't like it, we just have to do it. It's in our nature.
Right. It's like a subconscious racism that they might not even realize they're doing. You know, we're gonna test Serena because how is this black woman big with muscles? How is she doing all this? How is she beating everybody else?
Oh, like it's called push-ups.
Exactly.
That's what it's called push-ups.
Push-ups, sit-ups, right, all that.
Just try better. And, you know, I think the more she wins, you know, the more she wins, the deeper the anger becomes. Like you said, you asked the question, well, why would they kill their big, you know, do their biggest star? And again, it's like, it's almost like the racism negates it. That, you know, it's just a mere sight. And remember, there's been an issue with her since her dad. I mean, they've been kind of crazy about the Williams sisters and the family for a long time. But you make peace because what can you do? Because they're beating you. I mean, what are you going to do? You know.
Like, you can translate this to other sports. Like, you mentioned them earlier. Like, there was I was living down here the first time I lived in Atlanta when Michael Vick was Michael Vick.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Vick was the face of the NFL. Do you think the NFL appreciated Michael Vick being the face of the NFL at that time?
Nope.
There was a point when Allen Iverson was the face of the NBA. You know how much David Stern did appreciate it? He implemented a dress code.
Yep.
Just because a star is the face of your league, that doesn't necessarily mean that people want it that way.
Right.
And I think that's the case here with Serena.
Yeah, I mean, because in sports, not like our profession, in journalism, where it's subjective, you know, basically in sports, in particular the blood sports, it's basically about who runs the fastest, who jumps the highest. So Michael Vick emerged, and what are you going to do? He's changing the face of things. You don't like it. You know, they kill. Well, they can't read it, whatever. But you basically can't control what he's doing on the field, you know, except to just try to do it. And then, you know, when he you know, when you stub your toe or you sabotage yourself, then you jump on them with full force. You know, and yeah. You know, but there's really nothing you could do in the realm of sports and play when people are successful, except to just try to wait until they fall or wait until they sabotage themselves. And Serena, like you were saying, Colin, you know, she's making money for people. You know, she's making money for people. Barry Bonds was making money for people. Michael Vick was making money for people. There's really nothing you could do about it except just wait. Bide your time, you know. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, how do you think this is going to play out?
I don't know. It'll be something that I'm going to monitor now that I know that this website exists and I can just check the database whenever I feel like it. Mm-hmm. But as I've learned in this role the past year, with the New York media tag attached to when I write things, me and my boss have notated that when I've called people to the rug, things have started to change. So it would be interesting to see how they go forth with this and if there are some more murmurings of testing and how that plays out in the next couple tournaments or in the next couple months as well.
The white supremacists go to the bottom of the ocean and study one grain of sand, bring it and put it under a microscope. The black person passes by and say, "What are you doing there, Ralph?" "See, I'm studying this grain of sand that I got 8,000 feet from the bottom of the ocean." "And what are you studying a grain of sand for?" "I'm studying it because it's there. And I'm going to find out why it's there. And I'm going to find out everything about it, how it got there, what it does while it was there, what it can be used for by me." To dominate you.
It's a new mystery for Egyptologists, a black granite sarcophagus discovered in Alexandria, the largest ever found there, which is believed to have lain unopened for more than 2,000 years. The newsroom's Richard Hamilton reports on what secrets the sarcophagus may hold.
It's nearly 3 metres long and 2 metres high and weighs more than 30 tonnes. And no one knows who or what is inside. Its discovery has fueled speculation that it could be the long-lost tomb of Alexander the Great, the Macedonian king who conquered much of the ancient world. That speculation has intensified following the discovery of an alabaster head near the tomb. Egypt's Ministry of Antiquities says it's from the early Ptolemaic period, which began after the death of Alexander in 323 BC. If it is the tomb of Alexander, it would be one of the greatest archaeological finds of all time. But officials are playing down the excitement by suggesting it's more likely to be that of an Alexandrian nobleman. As the sarcophagus is so heavy and lies 5 metres underground, lifting and opening it will be extremely difficult. So in the coming weeks, a team of engineers will provide heavy lifting equipment and structural supports so that archaeologists can try to remove the lid, which alone weighs 15 tonnes. A layer of mortar between the lid and the rest of the sarcophagus indicates that it has not been opened since it was first used more than 2 millennia ago. Alexander the Great died in Babylon. Some classicists believe his body was thrown, according to his wishes, into the river Euphrates. But others say the Greek general Ptolemy took the corpse to Memphis in Egypt, where it was later buried in Alexandria.
And that report by Richard Hamilton.
I wonder if it seems like we have been conditioned to associate minors with romance. Like we will say, you know, my girl, or you know, we'll the females will say, you know, boy, come here, and it's supposed to be a term of endearment, and we talk about a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and we say baby to, you know, to endear our mates, even in a sexual way. And I wonder if that is from the white supremacist conditioning us that way, because there's just this big push for pedophilia.
It is a disturbing issue, but one that is growing. The production of millions of pornographic images of children being sexually abused. They are uploaded from cell phones, webcams, and computers. John Ferrugia of Rocky Mountain PBS has the story of one family who was a victim and explores what you can do to protect your children.
There was a card on our front door from the FBI, and immediately our hearts sank. You know, we thought, why is the FBI contacting us?
7 years ago, Beth and her husband couldn't imagine what the FBI wanted, but they agreed to meet.
They said, we believe your son has been a victim of a crime. And I said, impossible. My son is at home. And he showed me the photos, and immediately I just broke down. My husband broke down crying.
What she saw was her then 4-year-old son being sexually abused, the acts documented in still images and video and uploaded to the internet. It had been going on for 2 years.
And they asked us if we knew who the person was and where he could be located.
And did you?
I did. He actually was a family friend that we had known for a long time, almost my whole life.
It's your neighbor. It's your pastor. It's your teacher. It's your soccer coach. We've had all of those types of people. People with kids, people without kids.
FBI Special Agent Tina Forkas has been investigating internet child pornography in the Denver field office for more than 7 years.
I wish there was some magic profile where we could identify these people, but there's not.
It was Forkas, along with agents in Illinois, Missouri, Arizona, and Colorado, who were able to identify her son. Through their investigation, they discovered he had been a victim in a multi-state child porn ring, and the agents tracked down those who had sexually abused him for years.
My son was going to my dad's house. My dad also had some people that were helping him out and providing care and resources at his house.
So he had no idea?
He had absolutely no idea.
The men, one married with two children and the other single, who had access to Beth's son, were arrested and convicted. The break in the case came with the arrest of this man, Richard Franklin. He is a 50-year-old military veteran who lived in this quiet Denver neighborhood with his parents, who knew nothing about their son's criminal obsession.
You take a quick walk around the house, and you immediately know usually who your subject is, because it's the bedroom with all the computers and all the keyboards.
FBI photos from their search of the house show how Franklin closeted himself with his computers, where he could view images he collected of children being sexually abused.
He had hundreds of thousands of images and videos of child pornography.
Hundreds of thousands?
Yes, hundreds of thousands.
Franklin's images of sexually abused children stored on hard drives were being traded with like-minded predators all over the U.S. and beyond. Franklin was advertising for child porn, receiving images, including those of Beth's son, and trading images from his collection. Franklin was convicted and sentenced to 100 years in federal prison. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, known as NCMEC, works with federal, state, and local law enforcement to identify children in photos who are being sexually abused. Here's how it works. Internet service providers like Google, Yahoo, and others monitor the billions of uploads and downloads of material with algorithms that search for possible child pornography. When it's detected, the providers review them and contact NCMEC, sending a sample of the image as well as information about the web server and the address. It is then passed along to the FBI for possible investigation.
We're able to run those images against known images that NCMEC has, and that may play a part in victim identification.
Calvin Shivers is the special agent in charge of the FBI office in Denver. He previously headed the Violent Crimes Against Children section at FBI headquarters. He says in Colorado, about 50% of child porn cases investigated are derived from tips from internet providers through the nonprofit.
A lot of times when you just get a general tip, there may not be enough information. But NCMEC, because of the experienced staff, they're able to, in some instances, call additional information that may help the investigation.
The number of tips compiled by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has exploded in recent years. In 2010, there were more than 213,000 tips involving child pornography. In 2017, the number of tips was more than 10 million.
The number of cases that are happening, it's an avalanche. I mean, we just feel like we're dishing the ocean out with a spoon.
Judy Smith is chief of the Cybercrime and National Security Section of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Denver.
Nobody wants to know that this dark side of humanity exists, and not just exists, but the scope of it.
Judy Smith says another growing concern involves increasingly younger kids carrying smartphones.
They can take pictures of themselves, and they can send those to their friends or somebody who they think are friends. There's online predators out there who pose as young boys or girls who then entice or ask kids to self-produce child pornography.
I know you've been waiting for this for a while.
And FBI Special Agent Tina Forcas says once just one photo is sent by an unsuspecting child or teen to a predator posing online as another kid, as illustrated in this NCMEC training video,
they can be blackmailed or they're too embarrassed to say anything, so they continue to send pictures.
To emphasize the point, Forcas noted that while we were conversing on an upper floor of the FBI building in Denver,
people are actively posting child pornography on one of my undercover computers downstairs. There's a little girl on that site. You can tell she's self-producing. I mean, she's holding the cell phone out. She's nude. She's maybe 10, 11 years old. And we're seeing this live on this site. Why is she taking pictures of herself? Where are her parents?
You know, parents should be cognizant of what their children are doing on the internet and on their smartphones just across the board.
And FBI Special Agent in Charge Calvin Shivers says it goes beyond monitoring.
Parents should also make sure that there's a good avenue for their children to communicate. And if they had that conversation, that the children know that they can come to them. To your point, a lot of the victims don't feel that they can talk to their parents, and that causes them to be re-victimized over and over again.
For Beth's son and for her family, ongoing therapy has brought them beyond trauma to hope.
How does your son see his future?
Oh, just very positive. He's also going to have this story to go with it that, you know, I dealt with this as a child, and look, here I am, and you can get through it, too.
Beth and her family say they hope public discussion of this horrific crime will bring public awareness and reduce the stigma for victims whose childhood photos often remain accessible on the web, and that it will help victims and their families heal. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Ferrugia in Denver.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
Political fireworks at a city council meeting, with one person even calling for the mayor pro tem's resignation.
The furor is over a Facebook post that some have deemed racist. The message was posted by Carrollton council member and mayor pro tem Gerald Byrd.
Now, Fox 5's George Franco was in that meeting and joins us live with Byrd's response to all the criticism. George?
Well, Russ and Sine, Mayor Pro Tem Gerald Byrd told me this isn't about him. He says that he hopes his controversial Facebook post will lead to some kind of public forum on the ills of society, especially the black community here in Carrollton, which was just fine with a lot of folks. They just don't like the way he went about it.
Cops were called on me for celebrating my mother's birthday at my house.
Carrollton Mayor Pro Tem Gerald Byrd spoke of prejudices he's experienced. It was part of his response to pushback from a Facebook post showing a Native American against a black man with the caption, "The genocide of one race, the enslavement of another," followed by Byrd's response, "White man has and is destroying the world." It's a statement which many people in Carrollton have been talking about and saw as racist, including Barry Harwell.
I do think that racism will never really end as long as we're entitled to offer up our personal opinions.
I'm quoting you, "White man has and is destroying the world." Is that a racist comment?
I don't think that's a racist comment at all. You know, when I think about my position here at City Hall, every day it seems I'm dealing with some sort of issue of racial discrimination or racial prejudice.
Byrd operates a nonprofit, the downtown-based Institute of Imagination, which a Carrollton businessman is asking others to boycott with him.
He's making disparaging remarks regarding an entire race. Such racism in our community is what frankly disgusting.
Bird's Facebook post has Minnie and Carrollton talking, but he asked us not to show the post, which has led to at least one call for his resignation.
Asking you to resign, Mr. Bird, would be futile. But I ask you to consider it.
Does anybody here deserve an apology?
Well, you know, it's not about me per se. It's more about disenfranchised people, the poor, and their struggles every single day.
As far as the call for the resignation, Mr. Bird says that he is respects the man who made that call, but he says he frankly wasn't a person who put him into office. He says the voters are the important part of that story, and we'll continue this story with that part later on Fox 5 News Edge at 11. But for now in Carrollton tonight, I'm George Franco, Fox 5 News.
All right, thanks so much, George.
You claim I'm selling crap, but you be doing that. The last Emperor KRS-One and Big Zach. Need I say the CIA be criminals in action? Cocaine crack unpacking, high surveillance tracking. Prominent blacks and whites giving orders for mass slaughters. I want all my daughters to be like Maxine Waters.
Not fit to be a lawyer, that's what Summer's saying after a local gang prosecutor was caught making vulgar attacks online against immigrants and Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
Now, that prosecutor has now been placed on leave by the district attorney. And tonight, KCALLINE's Nicole Comstock has reaction from community activists.
The district attorney says these comments absolutely cross the line of free speech because people all across the country are questioning the integrity of this office.
I was offended by the comments.
San Bernardino County District Attorney Mike Ramos announcing Monday that Deputy District Attorney Michael Selyem was placed on administrative leave. He is now under investigation for allegedly making a slew of racist comments on social media.
The San Bernardino County District Attorney's office does not condone hate, discrimination, or incitement of violence.
The San Bernardino Sun reports Selyem posted several offensive comments on Facebook regarding immigrants, the victim of an officer-involved shooting, and Congresswoman Maxine Waters. In the post, which has since been taken down, Selyem writes, being a loud-mouthed expletive in the ghetto, you would think someone would have shot this expletive by now.
So for us, that is fighting words, and that's why we're here. Let him know we'll take this fight right to his doorstep.
Najee Ali is with Operation Hope, a community group working in underserved neighborhoods. He says this isn't just about race, but calling out right from wrong.
He's an equal opportunity racist, and we all should be concerned that this man has power over people's lives. And that's why he must go, because he can never be trusted again. He does not have the integrity, the character, or the morals to serve.
Ramos says the DA's office has no indication Selyem used bias in any of the cases he prosecuted, but will review any if necessary as part of this investigation.
Our community and the entire criminal justice system depends on having a fair, ethical, and unbiased prosecutor.
We reached out to Selyem for a comment, but we have not yet heard back from him. In San Bernardino, Nicole Comstock, KCAL 9 News.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation.
After a trial lasting 5 years, a court in Munich has delivered its verdict in one of modern-day Germany's biggest criminal cases involving neo-Nazis and racially aggravated murder. The main defendant, a woman called Beate Szepa, has been found guilty of murdering 10 people, including ethnic Turks, a Greek citizen and a policewoman. Our correspondent Jenny Hill is in Berlin and told me more.
Beate Szepa and two male accomplices who actually later killed themselves formed, if you like, the core of what they referred to as the National Socialist Underground, or NSU. And over 7 years or so, they carried out this spate of 10 killings, a number of bomb attacks, a number of bank robberies, very unpleasant stuff. Now, we don't know a lot about their motive, but apparent motive is that they simply wanted to spread terror and fear throughout the Turkish community. The majority of their victims, as you know, were were Turkish people who'd come to Germany and started new lives here. There are suggestions that perhaps the Greek man who was killed, they mistakenly identified as a Turk. It's impossible to say. And the reason we don't know so much about this is because during this five-year, extraordinarily long trial, Beata Schaper, that the main defendant, has only spoken twice. She's not answered victims' families' questions as to why their loved ones were specifically chosen. And they really were targeted. The group would carry out a reconnaissance before then turning up later and shooting them dead at close range. Very, very unpleasant stuff. But I think what's really interesting and shocking about this trial is that it doesn't end the story. Of course, Schaper will appeal, but there are so many fundamental questions which are still unanswered. A number of parliamentary inquiries have also failed to properly address them. This neo-Nazi cell was able to carry out these killings, these bombings, with absolute impunity over 7 years, and that's because the German authorities wrongly assumed that the victims had simply been caught up in some kind of immigrant gang crime. If I tell you that they were referred to as the kebab murders, that probably tells you all you need to know about the attitude of the German authorities investigating at the time. There are accusations of institutionalised racism on the part of the authorities. Big questions over the fact that they paid informants from within the neo-Nazi community too. Now, a lot of questions. We don't know whether they knew that they were part of the neo-Nazi community. They certainly didn't give any very helpful information. So big scandal there. But really, that question remains, and it's there for the victims too, who, on the one hand, welcome today's verdict, but on the other hand, are saying, well, come on, you know, why? Why can't we know more about why my loved ones were selected? And secondly, and most importantly of all, why did the German authorities fail to protect them?
Jenny Hill in Berlin.
So something, that means that something is wrong with our conceptualization about the problem. See, like, I have a sister who's in Chicago, very sick in the hospital. And the big question, what is wrong? What, you know, in other words, she's having these symptoms. But the big question for the doctors to determine is, what is going on that is causing? See, not just the symptoms, but what is causing? And so this is where this question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today, the Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
In the past month, you might have heard about stories such as these.
You had no right to do what you did.
That's a viral video from a few weeks ago where a black mother and child were staying at a Pasadena hotel, hanging out at the pool. Then another guest, a white man, asked her and only her, no other guest, if they showered before going into the water.
You asked me if I showered.
You're the only one in the pool.
There's plenty of people over there in the pool.
You're the only one in the pool.
There are three other people over there.
There's also this recent incident.
Why do you hate us? Because we're Mexicans?
That's a Latino man on a landscaping job in San Bernardino County being verbally confronted by a white woman. In it, she called Mexicans rapists, animals, and drug dealers.
Rapists? How many people have I raped? How many drugs have I dealt?
Many more racially charged incidents such as these have gone viral lately, and because they're so visible on social media, they may seem like they're happening frequently. But are they? To find out the answer, we have Edward Dunbar, practicing psychologist and clinical professor at UCLA. He's also editor of the book, Hate Unleashed: America After the 2016 Election. Welcome. Now, are these on the rise?
You know, this is a very difficult thing to speak to in an absolute sense because we really don't do a good job of tracking this sort of thing. But there is evidence to suggest since the 2016 election that indeed there has been an increase throughout the country in these kinds of non-criminal hate incidents.
Now, we've got to be absolutely clear. They're not crimes. They're incidents, hate incidents. Hate crimes actually go through the justice system. They become official stats. And these incidents are informally told by the person involved or actually shared online. So I'm wondering then, how are incidents tracked in any meaningful way if they're not officially crimes?
You know, there's a variety of things. There are things such as community networks, organizations that actively try to get people to come forward and report these things, such as Southern Poverty Law Center, which, of course, also tracks things like hate violence. We have the Human Rights Campaign, again, another national organization. We have CAIR, which has been very good at documenting a lot of non-criminal anti-Muslim activities. And then we have various immigration rights groups that sometimes are more regional that similarly will document what's going on in their communities. And A, what's interesting, sometimes these are the folks that will hear about the kind of borderline, maybe this is a crime, maybe it's not, that law enforcement may never be told about. So they are kind of having a pulse on the community sometimes much more effectively than our black and white units going out to the scene. But, you know, there's an interesting point here, which is that a hate incident in the state of California will be reported and recorded by law enforcement. They will do this in only two cases, that is for domestic nonviolent confrontations and for hate activity, which is still not criminal. So we do have, you know, a process by which we can use law enforcement to kind of keep tabs on things going on in our communities.
How is that information then used? And how do citizens actually make sure that it's collected properly?
One of the ways that it's collected, of course, if it's going through our law enforcement agencies, is that a responding officer will come out and make a determination that there was something going on which was a concern. They may determine pretty quickly to say, well, you know, this is essentially First Amendment free speech. But they may also appreciate the fact that it is borderline to intimidation or that it may be a precursor to subsequent violence. And this gets to an old idea, what they used to call the broken windows hypothesis, of you watch a community start to change and go into a place where it's a greater risk for intergroup violence. And the use of hate speech, you know, in the United States is largely legal unless there's a explicit threat of harm. But law enforcement can document this. And, you know, I used to work inside the LAPD with the criminal conspiracy unit. We would, you know, tease out and say, well, this is not a crime. However, look at the presence of the hate speech. Look at the impact it had on the people in a given community, a street, a neighborhood.
And what would be the benefit to just kind of seeing, okay, look what's there? Is it just for the future in case it becomes something else?
When we start to think about things such as young adults and adolescents where hate speech is common, it may be the precursor to retributional violence that may occur literally within the same day. And individuals may also escalate. I mean, I've tracked enough offenders over the years where you say, you know, they were doing these things that were borderline, and then they go across the line, and now they do the assault.
Are hate incidents on the rise? We're talking about it with Edward Dunbar, practicing psychologist and clinical professor at UCLA. Now, despite the increase in these kinds of events, could it be, Edward, that just reporting is actually higher, as in more people are willing to share that an incident happened to them rather than actual incidents increasing?
Right. We have to say it's a difficult thing to be absolutely sure about because there has been greater sensitivity of advocacy groups since the election to say, you know, we are concerned for our constituents. So we know that there's more awareness in some communities since the election. And the people we're now seeing on these, videos and we're hearing in the audio tapes, these are individuals that are probably simply getting a sense of being given permission in the new cultural environment we're in, that it's all right to sort of assert privilege and to threaten people.
So permission, though, who would be granting that permission?
Well, the easy answer is some of the social media outlets. The other piece of this is the ambivalence we see in the federal government at this point. You know, I've known some hate crime offenders over the years who will say, well, I don't think the government really cares if I harass these people. And I think that's part of what we're seeing that's starting to change here, you know, with the tone of the current Trump administration. We're seeing situations that for some individuals in our society really feel like it's really okay to be aggressive with people that we see as being racially and ethnically different or an immigrant.
All right, Edward, so let's just say someone is going through an incident such as the ones we've been talking about, what should they do to document it? I would imagine tip number one involves your cell phone.
Right. Any way of memorializing it is really important. Work I have done over the years, research I've done over the years, say if you are the victim of a hate incident, not even a hate crime, you're much more likely to tell your friends or your family than you are to go to law enforcement, than you are to go to an institutional leader.
So something like this happens, you got it on tape. What should people expect out of it?
To know that there are groups and there are people that will say, we don't consider this acceptable, and to let the person know that they're not alone and vulnerable with this. Because it may not be criminal, but it can change the behavior of the individual.
Edward Dunbar, practicing psychologist and clinical professor at UCLA. He's also editor of the book Hate Unleashed: America After the 2016 Election. Edward, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ace.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Only a third of complaints about King County Sheriff's deputies in 2016 ever stood a chance of being taken seriously. That's according to a report commissioned by the office that oversees policing in King County. KUOW's Carolyn Adolph has more.
In 2016, members of the public lodged nearly 700 complaints against King County officers. But because of the way complaints are handled by the sheriff's office, two-thirds of the complaints were funneled away from the formal complaint process. Of the cases stamped not about misconduct, the report's author found serious complaints, including sexual assault and violations of authority. And in cases labeled minor misconduct handled by supervisor, the report found most investigations were incomplete. Complaints could be downgraded by investigators, but not one was escalated in seriousness. And the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight didn't find out about the hundreds of complaints excluded from the formal disciplinary process. We would recommend a system that eliminates the current system, the report's author wrote. The sheriff's chief of staff, Liz Rocha, went to King County Council's Law and Justice Committee to discuss the report. She called for more investigators.
We want to do this right. We want to keep and maintain the public's trust, and transparency is very, very important to us. So we want to have more staffing in that unit.
Rocha also said the sheriff was taking steps to improve investigators' independence, such as moving their office away from the sheriff's office. I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
I was just watching John Tory on the TV responding to yet another shooting, a fatal shooting in the city of Toronto in the area of Jane and Driftwood. The mayor's quote that was pulled for the story from CTV was him saying that there are no easy answers to gun violence in the city of Toronto. That's not true, John. John, why are you lying? There is an easy answer. It's the answer that you and so many others have relied on in the past week because you don't know what else to do. And it's to vent your anger at black people. It's to exhibit this white rage that doesn't seem to matter for any other crime in the city except gun violence. And it's to start saying things that you don't usually say in other contexts except around black people.
Context.
So suddenly John Tory is using all of this language in the last week during a series of gun murders in the city of Toronto, a language that I don't think I hear John Tory ever using, and which a lot of people actually, thinking of this seemingly mild-mannered white milquetoast conservative guy, wouldn't attribute to John Tory. But he's trying to get to y'all, you know? John Tory knows that there's a really right-wing, populist, racist backlash going on around here, and he's trying to ride the wave. So suddenly, John Tory is using words like, gangster, I'm going to go after the gangsters. And we all know what that means in the city of Toronto. But maybe that's not enough. So just to make sure that John Tory knows that you feel how angry that he is as a white person, he says, we're going to get these thugs and we're going to lock up these thugs. And he uses the word thug. John, why don't you just call us the N-word? We know what you're talking about. You have a job in the city of Toronto, and it's not to lead outrage. If you have something that you want to put forward about gun violence in the city of Toronto, John Tory, put it forward. But to use words like thug, baby, 'cause I'm a thug, that's your solution to express this white rage that is already endangering our lives? How dare you? But John Tory's not done, everybody, because John Tory really wants to make sure that you know how upset he is about gun violence. And not just at the individuals who are perpetrating the violence. No, he has a larger language. John Tory used the term anti-social sewer rats, as quoted in the Globe and Mail, to describe people that he believed were responsible for one of these shootings. Anti-social sewer rats. Sewer rats. To speak about human beings. That's the mayor of your city. I don't care what your political leaning is. Don't tell me that it's the job of the mayor of Toronto to call people rats in the middle of a crisis. How dare you, John Tory? Is this how you do your job? By calling human beings vermin? How many times do we have to talk about how dangerous that is? But you only do it for us, John. You only bring out this language showing your anti-blackness and the anti-blackness that you expect of other people. You do it for us. But a man drives a car up on the sidewalk and runs over innocent people and you don't use that language. And men beat their wives to death in the city of Toronto and you don't use that language. And by the way, talking about violence against women, as we did last week on this show. When the police try to scare you right now during the violence that's happening, and they tell you about the astronomical number of homicides in the city of Toronto, they're including the man who rode over 10 people with his car. But we already forgot about that story, as I mentioned last week. So you don't think about that. You just think about a black person with a gun when all these people start citing their statistics about homicide. And Toronto's not even close to the most violent city in terms of gun murder in Canada. Like, not even close. But we see all of these people trying to capitalize right now on this feeling of white rage because we don't know what to do to stop the violence. But as long as we can express our anger at black people, we think that we're doing our job. John Tory, what you're doing is despicable. What you're doing, naming our communities in these ways, using this dehumanizing language, you'd better say nothing at all than to say this. You'd be better to keep your mouth shut than to call us thugs and gangsters and rats. And if you think that using that language is going to solve the problem, please stop talking because you have no idea what you're doing to us. Or worse than that, you know exactly what you're doing to us. And you don't mind. Is this a re-election ploy, John? All of this anger at black people, is this to show that you're going to be tough? Mayor Tory talking about bail and how what we really need to do is we need to stop people from getting out on bail so easily. John Tory, do you have any proof that any of the recent shootings have anything to do with bail? Have you offered one example of a shooting in Toronto recently that had something to do with a person getting out of bail before you thought that they should? Do you have even one example? No. But in the absence of policy, white rage will always do. And I'm sorry to say that that's what we're seeing here in the city of Toronto, is a whole lot of anger expressed at our community. And I want to know when that has helped. I'd also really like to know, while we're talking about this, and we brought it up with Pascal DeVerlis earlier on today, when has more policing ever helped reduce crime? Where is this evidence? If it was so obvious, then police states and military states would be the safest places in the world to live, because there are police everywhere, right? When you put police on every street corner, that shows that you are a free and open and safe society, right? No. Nobody wants to live in those cities. But you see, you guys don't mind when you do it to black communities, because all of these calls for more carding again, all of these calls for extra policing again, they're not going to go into white communities where you guys live. They're going to come to our communities and target our children. So you guys don't mind the calls for the police state to be increased, knowing that it's not going to be your family, but it's going to be ours. And so we can't allow that to happen, you see. But the rhetoric isn't doing any good, John Tory. Nobody believes you. You're just showing your anti-black racism when you use these terms like thug and gangster and rat. You know, a lot of us in the black community get very angry about violence too, but we don't use this language. We don't go out into the street when we're organizing or when we're doing our activism and when we're trying to call attention to violence. We don't use those opportunities to dehumanize people, even though they are dehumanizing us. You can't find a time in 3.5 years on this air that I have ever used that kind of language that John Tory is now using against his own civilians. I have never used that language against anybody, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who regularly gets to come on air in this city or in the newspaper or anywhere in the public who regularly uses dehumanizing language while they're talking about violence. Because that's not really the point. The point is that people are losing their lives. Do we really have to talk again about what is wrong and about why our city looks the way that it does? Do we really have to talk about a city where you can't afford childcare, where you can't afford the basics of a house that you can keep over your head, where TCHC is closing down units, where whole communities are being left behind, but you want to wait until a gun goes off before you solve the problem? John Tory, your neoliberal administration is the reason why people are living in poverty. It's a huge contributor to this society that we're living in that's taking away from people who have very little. And if you want to do something, you're right, there is no easy answer. So why are you calling out black people if there's no easy answer and using this disgusting and foul language to talk about us?
Niggers, alligators, apes, coons, and possums.
See, it used to be we could beat up minorities and nobody cared. It's the reason a lot of us joined the force. Hey, Mitch, you want to go down and arrest some homeless people but not be able to beat up any minorities? No, thank you. Yeah, no, I think we're good.
A new bombshell report in the Miami Herald details how a police chief in a small town, a small suburb, Biscayne Park, is accused of telling his officers to arrest random black people in order to just boost stats. And this is from one of the officers in the report. Anthony De La Torre says they were told if they have burglaries that are open cases that are not solved yet, if you see anybody black walking through our streets and they have somewhat of a record, arrest them so we can pin them for all the burglaries. And he's not the only officer. Four officers, which is comes up to a third of the small force, told an outside investigator they were under marching orders to file these bogus charges to improve the department's crime stats. The police chief in question, Raimundo Atesiano, denies all these allegations. He quit the force back in 2014. But I want to tell you this. During his two-year tenure, 29 of 30 burglary cases were solved. And the year after he left, the force didn't solve any. Not one. The year after he left.
Because right-wingers are not that bright, I have to explain that. Because okay, they're going to think, oh, you see that? That led to more crime.
Yeah.
No, they hadn't solved any of the cases in the past. They were just pinning it on the wrong guys. All these cops are saying it. Oh, yeah, they were just arresting random black guys, right? So when they stopped doing that, it turns out they weren't solving any of the cases.
It also means that there is a good possibility that any competent defense attorney is going to get every single person who was convicted during that time off, right?
And some of them did do it.
Some of them will have done it. And you'll have inevitably then put some legitimate bad guys back on the street because you guys are so friggin' incompetent and racist.
This police chief in question is actually in trouble with the feds for one specific case. They've only got one going right now, but he's charged with framing a black teenager, a 16-year-old, I think, for four different burglaries, even though federal prosecutors say they knew there was no evidence to support any of these charges.
Whatever the maximum sentence is for four different burglaries, mm-hmm. that's how long Chief, I don't remember his name already, belongs in prison.
Atesiano.
That's how long Chief Atesiano. But he deserves to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Yeah, it's stunning to me how little they care about other people. Like, you're going to put them in prison. You're going to take away their liberty, even though you know they didn't do it. Why? Because it's going to improve your career by this much. Mm-hmm. You get to brag about how good you are at solving crime when you know you're not solving crime. And think about that too, guys. Not only are they putting all these people in and taking away their freedom, okay, but at the same time, people get to do burglaries nonstop in that town.
Yeah,
you're not actually
right.
doing the policing.
So people keep getting victimized, and then, you know, you have people who didn't commit the crime going to prison for, again, a crime that they didn't commit. And look, remember, he specifically said to single out black people in the community. So please spare me the arguments about how there's no institutional racism in the country, because this is a perfect example of
this. This was burglaries. You think sometime in the last 30 to 40 to 50 years in this country that's happened for murder? And that maybe we have a couple of black guys, let alone white guys, on death row who didn't do it. If you think that, you're out of your freaking mind.
20 of them get out every year.
That's right.
Yeah, and so, guys, if it didn't happen to you, it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, unfortunately, for a lot of African Americans, this is their experience. This is what they've lived in so many different areas for so long. So it doesn't mean you did it. This guy did it. He did it because he's lazy, and he did it because he's a bad guy. But it happened to a lot of black people in this country. So just recognize it so that we could all fix it together.
Black babies cost less.
Over the past few days, we've been bringing you stories about a scary statistic. Black babies in the United States are twice as likely to die before their first birthday as white babies. KPCC's Priska Neely has been investigating what's behind this gap and what's being done to close it. Today, she leaves California and heads to the Midwest, where Ohio is trying to deal with some of the highest black infant mortality rates in the nation. In her final installment, Priska tells the story of a community that found a few tangible things that moms and dads can do to help.
It's Mother's Day at Family Baptist Church in Toledo, Ohio. During this joyous service, Pastor Charles McBee carves out some time to educate the congregation on a grim topic. Stacy Scott steps up to the pulpit and launches into a talk she gives dozens of times each month.
We are seeing these babies not make it to their first birthday.
Black babies in Toledo are three times as likely to die in their first year of life. Scott tells the congregation about the impact of racism and chronic stress, but her message is about something they can do now.
What we know, by simply putting a baby on their backs to sleep, you can reduce the risk of a baby dying.
Most of the black babies who die are born premature, too small to make it. But there are also higher rates for sleep-related deaths as babies grow.
And knowledge is the key to make a difference. So I say to you, not only does it take a village to raise a child, it takes a village to save one. Thank you very much.
There's a reason that Scott has spent decades trying to get the word out to the black community about safe sleep. She's trying to tackle a huge problem, this infant mortality gap that's persisted for decades in this country, by focusing on one small piece.
We could talk about racism. We can talk about housing. And I mean, a lot of these things are systematic.
Hard for any single family to disentangle and really do something. So she wants to give black parents tangible tools to make sure their babies make it through their first year.
So if I'm an African-American parent who has just brought my baby home and I'm just trying to be the best parent I can be, one thing I can do is to keep my baby safe.
Policymakers in the past have targeted individual behavior as a way to explain and sometimes even blame parents for the death of their children. This isn't that. This is about empowering communities with information and resources that can make a difference. That's why Scott created the Global Infant Safe Sleep Center, to get the message out and to also fill another void.
We always worked with moms and babes, but I thought it would be great to be able to bring the dad into the conversation.
Noble men of Capitol Sun.
Now that conversation is happening. Scott helped to form a partnership with Kappa Alpha Psi, a black fraternity with chapters all over the country.
You don't want the crib to look like that.
In May, she led a training session for a group of Kappas in Toledo.
What's wrong? What's some of the things you see?
Face down.
Face down. Baby's on his stomach.
Huge big pillow.
The fraternity has taken on safe sleep as one of its national initiatives. More than 5,000 men across the country, undergraduates, alumni, elders, have gotten training like this.
You got blankets in there as well?
No blankets. Just the crib, mattress, a tight fitted sheet.
Scott gives the men a full picture of the infant mortality issue, talking about racism and chronic stress and what they can do to help.
You can help shield the stress that many of these women experience.
She wants to create ambassadors who can spread this message.
You know, it's one thing coming from me, but that you all are able to tell other men about the impact that they have is just so much better.
21-year-old Adam Willis is a student at the University of Toledo.
Being informed now, you know, because I don't have any children, so when I do, I'll be well informed of what to do and what not to do.
At campuses across the country, chapters are taking the message and making it their own. At Florida Atlantic University, Kappas went around campus with a crying doll, showing their classmates how to make a crib safe. And they made this video.
Is the area safe?
No, it's not.
So can you make it safe?
So many early childhood issues are siloed into the world of maternal child health, and Scott wants to break down those walls.
We call it a movement, getting men to really be able to champion the fact that they do matter, that dads do matter too.
And for every dad or future dad who learns about safe sleep, she's trying to grow the village that will save Black babies. Covering early childhood, I'm Priska Neely.
There are more of Priska's stories from her series that you can read online. Find them on LAist.com.
Black babies cost less.
But first, the Department of Justice is reopening the investigation into the 1955 murder of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old African-American boy whose brutal killing by two white men in Mississippi became a galvanizing event that helped to spark the civil rights movement in America. William Brangham has the latest on the decades-old case and a warning. There are some very disturbing images in this report.
Emmett Till was a young boy from Chicago who, in 1955, was visiting family in Mississippi when he allegedly whistled at and made a sexual remark to a white woman named Carolyn Bryant and then grabbed her. This was the Jim Crow South, and for his alleged actions, Emmett Till was kidnapped by armed men, brutally beaten, and shot in the head. His killers took a heavy piece of farm equipment, tied it around his neck with barbed wire, and threw his body into the Tallahatchie River. It was discovered several days later. Till's mother, Mamie Till Bradley, demanded an open casket funeral for her son in Chicago. She wanted to show the nation exactly what racist violence looked like. Tens of thousands of people came to see Till's mutilated body, and photos were published nationwide in mainly Black publications. The next month, two men, Carolyn Bryant's husband and his half-brother, were tried for Till's murder and acquitted by an all-white jury. In an interview afterwards, the men freely admitted they'd killed the young boy. Last year, Timothy Tyson's book, The Blood of Emmett Till, had this revelation. Carolyn Bryant admitted she lied about her interaction with Emmett Till, saying the teenager never, quote, grabbed her around the waist or uttered obscenities as she had testified at trial. Bryant added, quote, nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him. Timothy Tyson spoke with Jeffrey Brown about this revelation last year.
I certainly never thought she was telling the truth at trial. She's been, in hiding almost for at least 60-some years. It was her husband who did the killing and her brother-in-law. It's not clear what role she had in that.
But. In a letter to Congress, the Department of Justice said it was reopening the investigation into Till's murder based on the discovery of new information, but it didn't specify what that information was or who might be the subject of their inquiry. Both of the admitted killers have since died.
Joining me now is Democratic Senator Doug Jones of Alabama. In his earlier life, Jones successfully prosecuted another famous decades-old civil rights case. He convicted two members of the Ku Klux Klan for the murder of four young Black girls in the 1963 bombing at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Senator, welcome to the NewsHour. I wonder if you could just give me your reaction to the news about this reopening of the inquiry into Emmett Till's case.
Well, I think it's pretty exciting. That's a decades-old case that needs as thorough a look as possible. It's an uphill battle on any of these old cases, but I think that one, of all the cases that are out there, certainly needs as thorough a look as possible. We'll see how it goes.
The DOJ has said that there is some new evidence, but they haven't explained what that evidence might be or who they are looking at. Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, obviously, they have seen some new evidence. I think there's some media reports about admissions that the wife of one of the former defendants who's now deceased has made. I think that's probably part of it. And I think the Justice Department over the years has been very active in trying to take a look at these old cases. From the time that I was U.S. Attorney in 1997, they have been pretty active consistently throughout the administrations with regard to these cases. If they can make a case, they will make a case. If they can't, they'll send it off to the state to see if the state can make a case, which is probably more likely in the case of the Emmett Till investigation, if a case can be made at all. It's an uphill battle.
Well, help me understand what you think might still be left to investigate, because the two men who were charged with the murder were exonerated, but they then admitted they had done it, but they have both died. The wife of one of the men admitted she perjured herself, but I believe the statute of limitations is up on that. So what is there still to investigate in your mind?
Well, there may be other people involved. The wife could still be involved. She could have been a part of this, the whole conspiracy, that the lying was just part of that. So I think that there's a way to, at least as far as the state statutes are concerned, to bring this into in a matter in which the statute of limitations would not have run. It really is going to depend on who it is that they're looking at and how it could connect to the crime itself, not just the abduction, but the murder itself.
Timothy Tyson, the scholar who wrote the book about Emmett Till and who we just heard from an old interview with Jeffrey Brown, gave a press conference today where he said the announcement of this inquiry is politically motivated. And he said it was basically to cover up what he described as the Trump administration's disgusting racial politics. Do you think that that's fair?
No, I really don't think that that's fair. The Civil Rights Division has been looking at this case, as well as many others, for again, as I said, since at least 1997 when I was the United States Attorney, and it's been other administrations. I actually heard that same kind of response about the George W. Bush administration 15, 16 years ago when they also took a look at this. You know, the thing is, and I can certainly understand why people would say that, but the fact of the matter is, this is still a murder case. It was still a heinous case that was never solved, and the two perpetrators died. If we can bring any kind of closure, if we can bring any kind of healing or any kind of prosecution, then I think we ought to give it our best shot, regardless of what the motives might be.
You prosecuted, as I mentioned before, another one of these decades-old cases where you had to go back and talk to people years and years after a crime had occurred. How difficult is that as a prosecutor to do that?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, you've got two different problems. You've got one that so many of the witnesses are now deceased. In this case, the two main perpetrators are now deceased. And then for those that are still alive, memories fade. Trying to pull those cases back together, it's a puzzle in which so many pieces of that puzzle are missing. And you just hope you can pull that puzzle together to show a picture of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's very, very difficult to do. Every day that passes, we lose the opportunity to actually prosecute these old cases.
Carolyn Bryant, the woman at the center of the Till case, who said that Till harassed her, she admitted that she lied on the stand. Could she be in legal jeopardy?
Well, I think it's possible. It depends on what happens after that. If the lying itself was part of an effort to simply grab this young man and kill him for whatever reason, but that was part of the plan, part of the conspiracy, then absolutely she could be. If she was present in the automobile when Till was abducted and the defendants knew that she was lying about this and this was a pretext to abduct and kill this young man, then absolutely she could be. I think that's a little bit difficult, but it absolutely, you know, stranger things have happened. And I think a lot of these cases, things have to line up just right. And so we'll just see how that goes.
You've introduced some legislation that would try to help this process along for many more civil rights cases. Can you explain what your legislation would do?
Sure. The legislation we introduced this week would try to create, it would create a commission through the National Archives so that these old cases can be assimilated, brought into one place, and an independent board can look at the files, all the records, to make those available to the public, to the media, to historians, to the communities. Because as I was just saying, not all of these cases, in fact, very, very few of these cases now can actually be prosecuted for any number of reasons. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to solve them. It shouldn't mean that these families should be denied access to the facts and the truth about what happened. And quite frankly, the community needs to know this, dude. The community needs to have that healing.
All right, Senator Doug Jones of Alabama, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Wade.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 14th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, any ideas motivated by the audio clips that we just heard. If you have any counter-racist suggestions, questions, give us a ring. 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the folks who dialed in. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Tremendous thanks to all of the cows, listeners, investors who have supported, kept us on the air for nearly a decade. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also support the cows. My Amazon wish list is also linked on my blog. It is linked at Amazon under Gus T. Renegade. I think Amazon's big shopping bonanza is supposed to be coming up on Monday. Feel free to nab an item or three for Gus T. Much obliged for all the folks who've nabbed items from my wish list over the years. Again, I hope the cows has been worthy of your generosity. And I hope we have given out constructive information, most importantly, about what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white. Other things to touch on. Let's see. Counter-racist t-shirt update. I told listeners, as folks get their shirts, as folks wear their shirts, and you get comments, observations, feel free to write in or call in or, you know, whatever, if you want to write it up, and we will share. Counter-racist t-shirt, again, the shirt says, or I think this person got the new one that says, please treat me like I am a white person. And again, if you would like a shirt, I think there are a limited number of shirts left, although it seems that we could probably order more if there was such a demand. Cows, C-O-W-S, shirt at gmail.com. And Dr. Trav will take excellent care of you, get you a shirt or two if you need multiple, but drop him an email. Do not contact Gus T about the shirts. Cowsshirt at gmail.com. Now, listener wrote in their experience. They write, just checking in with the counter-racist t-shirt experiences in northwestern Mississippi. Wowee. Emmett Till. The first person to recognize my shirt was my little sister. She thought the shirt was so cool. I asked if she wanted one, and she declined. Smart child. Next, I went to the store. No one said anything to me about it. Afterwards, my brother and I went to the dentist. The dental assistant, a suspected white supremacist, read my shirt aloud and said, "Stop." The dentist, who is also a suspected racist, laughed nervously. My brother told them that he told me not to wear the shirt. My mom was the last person to see my shirt, and her response to it was, "Girl, bye." Also, not sure if you remember me, but I was the female who called in about her child being ogled. I do remember. This listener, this was earlier this year, if I recall. She dialed in. I think they were at a pool. She had her young child. When I say young, I think we were talking like under three, very young child. She was in the pool, and the suspected racist was a woman. White woman comes over, and she says, "Do you mind if I ogle your child for, you know, a little while?" And I think, if I remember, the mom thought, didn't hear her correctly. I think she said the mom thought that this white woman wanted to hold her child or something. And so she, you know, recoiled and was repulsed, like, "Oh, no." And then the white woman, I guess, repeated, or somehow she found out that this white woman was requesting just to look at the child, but she used the word ogle. And I remember on that program, I think Roz pointed out the sexual connotation of the word. We read the definition. Words are important about, you know, the response and all that. Anyway, so now that you have been, we're all caught up to date. I really enjoyed the opinions you all gave. I'm definitely still learning, aren't we all? And after listening to you all, I feel like letting her look wasn't a good idea. Also, I'm not sure who suggested it, but paying close attention to definitions is absolutely great advice. It's definitely something I'm going to tell my son. White women are still trying to put their hands on him and ogle him. Unfortunately, I have been countering that by simply ignoring them and walking away. Any other suggestions to ignoring them would be greatly appreciated as well. A really funny situation happened, too, in regards to racist harassing my child. I guess I would just pause there. If we're talking about harassment, particularly harassment of black children, I don't pretend, or I generally don't find those to be incidents that are funny. I think a lot of times we, in responding to racism, white supremacy, humor is one of the ways that we deal with it. And I mean, if this is terrorism and serious, then this is certainly nothing to laugh at. Anyway, BGQ for everyone. Continuing. This little racist child excitedly ran up to me and realized what was in my front carrier was a baby. He sadly replied, "Aw, I thought it was a puppy." Racist man, racist woman, racist child, who is no older than 10. Also, I want to thank you all for being patient with my anxiety on the call I made. I figured it, if I had called in again, I would have been nervous. Hence, I wrote the email. No need to be nervous. We are all victims. Like you, we are all still learning. So no need to be nervous. Feel free to dial in. And I guess not just you, because I've heard that from lots of folks. We are all just victims of racism. I make mistakes and errors all the time. Victims, callers, they point them out on a regular basis. Some I catch myself, some I miss completely, but all of us are still making mistakes. And certainly there's no reason to be nervous when speaking with another victim of white supremacy. They're in the same position that you are, unfortunately. If we have any parents in particular, and I don't have children, so if we have any parents who are listening, if you have any other suggestions for white women specifically coming and requesting, I guess, to do any holding or ogling or anything else with your child, if you have any suggestions for how you deal with that to as quickly as possible neutralize that situation, let us know. Obviously, I don't have children, so that's not one that I've had to deal with. Next, we should be here tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, at 2:30 p.m. We're a little earlier, but it's early period because this is the Global Sunday Talk on Racism tomorrow. So it's at 2:30 p.m. Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific. We'll have our folks on from all over the globe to give us their thoughts, updates on what has transpired over the last few weeks all over the globe. That is tomorrow. Going back to words and the importance of words, our Black mother just wrote in about that. The segment, they were talking about the Black elected official. This program specifically, the compensatory call-in, that's one thing we're supposed to be very mindful about, words, word use, especially when we talk about racism, white supremacy. Now, the victim of white supremacy elected official, he was wrote something on Facebook, social media about racism. VGQ, victims guarantee qualified. He can say whatever he wants. He's a non-white person. However, my suggestion would be, really for any of us, especially if you are elected official or if you know that because of your job, because of your position or any other responsibilities, duties that you have, that your social media account, whites are going to be watching it and you might get in trouble. This might, you know, end up causing problems on your job or in some of the other duties that you have, what you've written on your social media page. So either you need to delete that account completely, which is what Dr. Kamau Kamban would advise, or you're going to have to be codified. Now, I think some of the things that he allegedly said in this Facebook post or social media post were that the white man is destroying the world. Now, certainly you can say that. I would make several adjustments, you know, my own status as a victim of white supremacy. My view, I said for almost a decade, from the very beginning, 2009, I and others have been saying racist man, racist woman, racist child. We should stop immediately saying white men, white man, any derivation of that should be stopped immediately. You are missing half of the racist equation. In my view, you might be missing the most important half of the racist equation, but that is a major error that should be stopped. I think that metaphor, I said we all make errors, that is a major part of the problem. We can even simplify. I like that even better. When you exclude racist woman, you are missing a major part of the problem of white supremacy. We should all discontinue the man or any other derivations of that. Next, some of the people that were responding, not just in that report where you had an elected non-white official who made those comments, but then where you had a white man who went on social media and was saying that Congresswoman Maxine Waters, she should be shot and she's ghetto and all this, talking about former First Lady Michelle Obama. Now, when he goes and makes his comments, first of all, they do not label his commentary terroristic threats. They throw all this other buckets of, that's a metaphor too, they toss out all these other incorrect terms, obfuscating, where it's hate language, racial remarks, offensive comments. They have lots and lots of terms that are incorrect. This is terroristic speech, terroristic threats, in fact, because he's saying, why hasn't she been shot? I mean, my goodness, against a publicly elected official. I think lashes years ago, this was like way back before President Obama was reelected in 2012, she was using the term 21st century post-Reconstruction. All of the terrorism that happened after the Civil War, whites organizing in their different terrorist cells to go out and kill, murder, torture, rape, pillage Black people. A key element of that was targeting elected Black officials. One of the best books that we've read, Ben Tillman, The Reconstruction of White Supremacy, one of my favorite books. Well, I don't know if it's top 10, but it's very informative, from the book club. They talk about that in targeting publicly elected Black officials. That's what's been going on for a whole year and a half now, with Congresswoman Maxine Waters. She seems to be front and center as one of the lead targets by many folks, and talking about her intelligence, and now just flat out terroristic threats, not hate speech. But in the report where they were talking about these terroristic threats, they had victims who were saying, these are fighting words, metaphor, not the best language, not the most accurate way to term what this is. Terroristic threats. And then also it was said in the same segment that the race soldier who made these comments, who was a prosecutor, that he is an equal opportunity racist. And I've heard that phrase before, equal opportunity racist. I've heard some people use that phrase to suggest that an individual practices racism against everybody, including whites, which, again, totally incorrect. We want to make sure that we use accurate language when we're talking about racism, white supremacy. I think sometimes it's just individuals are confused. And, you know, when you're confused about racism, white supremacy, the words are going to just be very, very sloppy, to say the least. Strive for accuracy, strive for precision when discussing white supremacy, racism. The segment on Emmett Till, Timothy Tyson, a suspected race soldier. I wrote about Mr. Tyson and his book, The Blood of Emmett Till, which came out last year during Black History Month. We had Keith Beauchamp on the program, who is real major in all of the more recent activity around the Emmett Till case. He's been a guest on the program repeatedly. He is the filmmaker. He did the documentary, The Story of Emmett Lewis Till, that came out in the last decade or so. Great documentary. You should check it out. If you have not seen it, he posted about the case being reopened. He gave a lot of great information. Timothy Tyson, white man, this guy said, or he had information that Carolyn Bryant Dunham, she remarried, that this suspected racist, the white woman who lied on Emmett Till, that she admitted that she lied. He had that information and did not reveal it, didn't even take it to the FBI when they were investigating this case back in like 2006, 2007, like over a decade ago. He didn't take this information to them. He didn't even take the information to the family. He waited, talked about this a long time, whites having constructive, important, critical information and withholding it. They wait. Sometimes they'll wait 50 years. Sometimes they'll wait 5 days, but that could be a critical 5 days. But he waited 10 years. And then, oh, yeah, I'm going to publish my book for Negro History Month. And, oh, yeah, this white woman did admit to lying about that old Emmett Till. Make sure you buy a copy of my book. Act of racism, but they leave all of that out in the PBS report and details. Same thing I've been saying the whole time that I've been speaking. Details. That PBS report, when they started at the beginning, all of these lies, allegations, she's admitted she lied, that he grabbed her, he whistled. I mean, oh my gosh, all of these detailed, specific comments about what he allegedly did that turns out, oh, this was a lie. They leave out the details that, oh, did these whites castrate Emmett Till? I mean, the savagery, it can't just be, oh, well, they took some farm equipment and punctured his skull and dumped his body. Like, no. Castration is an important aspect. We had that clip that talked about child pornography. Emmett Till was 14, might qualify as pornography, or pedophilia might qualify, but that gets left out consistently. That's what I mean. Racists, they're very strategic about which details they include. We'll include a lot of details about these lies. We'll leave out the white savagery to downplay that. They do that on a consistent basis all throughout that PBS segment, leaving out the details with Timothy Tyson as well. I'm looking forward to speaking with Mr. Beauchamp to see what he has to say. I remember we talked with a lot of detail when he was on the program last year, the second time in 2017, about Mr. Timothy Tyson and whether or not he was deliberately practicing white supremacy, withholding this information when he decided to publish his book, and even the way that he characterizes Carolyn Bryant Dunham in his book. You can check my article, in fact, where I wrote about all of this last year at Atlanta Black Star. I think Emmett Till's accuser, did she get away with murder? I think that's the title or something close to it. I'll post it during the broadcast. Last thing that I will say, the segment from California Public Radio about the black infant mortality rates, I think it's fantastic, certainly constructive. if you have black people and if black fraternity members, sorority members, if they're investing their time and energy valuing black children and trying to share constructive information to help care for black children, grand. No problem there at all. That said, I have been saying for about 8 months now, wow, what an interesting trend. Many, many media outlets across the United States, this is a topic that is now being focused on. The New York Times, the LA Times, this was, as I said, California Public Radio. These reports, and I mean, sometimes this will be like the front page, first article that you see if you go to the LA Times or if you get the New York Times, this will be the front page major report is about black maternal mortality rates, black mothers dying in pregnancy or having difficulties, and or black infant mortality rates. That's very interesting to have a spike in attention and focus on this. I, for one, don't think racists care about black children or black mothers, pregnant or not. Why are they doing this? We've talked about that. Some people have said that they think these statistics are lies. This is just more white supremacist propaganda to make us think that there's something wrong, that there's something defective about black mothers, about black children, black people in general. We've had other folks who said, hey, it's logic. It's medical apartheid. Certainly these issues are real and are the result of racism, white supremacy. But either way, it would still, for me, the question is, why is this being promoted so heavily at this particular point in time? Unless I'm in error about that, unless people have been seeing this many reports, I think I've played at least four or five just over the last 2 or 3 months. I just don't remember seeing. I'm not looking for these reports. I'll make sure I'm very clear. I'm not doing like an active Google search on a weekly basis to find reports that are related to these issues to keep talking about black maternal mortality rates. Not that these subjects should not be discussed, but in a system of racism, white supremacy, where black people have so many issues that get ignored and get no attention at all, why is this one all of a sudden now front page, daily, regular, consistent basis nationally? Just a question. With that, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If we could not use metaphors for this broadcast, that would be super appreciated. Racists, a major aspect of how they practice deception with words, metaphors. They'll use analogies and comparisons, similes to make two separate entities seem as though they are equivalent. They will insist, oh, these are almost identical. Frequently, that is not the case at all. This is just how they practice deception. Also, a lot of times these metaphors consciously, unconsciously have many other meanings to them than what we intend. A lot of times racists do this and they also convey a lot of racist thoughts with what they're talking about intentionally or not. Victims of white supremacy, a lot of times in our metaphors, we do the same. In addition to whatever else it is we're trying to compare, we will also include a lot of racist ideas. Many times this is done unconsciously. If we could just be as direct, explicit as possible, many of us, we're still learning. Sometimes we just haven't come to a conclusion on a particular subject. So we will substitute a metaphor for logic. And often it just adds to the confusion. If we could just be explicit, direct about what it is we want to say, that would be super appreciated. If you need more time to think, that is always acceptable. With that, if you could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be appreciated to make sure everyone has time to speak at least once. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be greatly appreciated. It just helps to not have to fight over a lot of background noise and echoing, distortion. Just make your commentary, use your mute button. If you have additional comments or questions, you can unmute yourself and rejoin us to share your second thoughts. With that, we will get the first few folks who dialed in with commentary. If you have a hand up and comments to share, first few people, line should be open. Proceed. And certainly, if we have parents, you should not be a spectator on this broadcast, since we do have a question posed. The question again, what to do if you consistently are having white women, I think she says specifically white women, who are pestering you to look at and or hold your small black child. If we have parents, how you would deal with that in the most efficient manner to not solve problems, that would be greatly appreciated. First few folks with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Gus, did you get the post that I put on your Facebook page about pedophilia?
I did not see it. I have not looked at my Facebook page during the broadcast. Do you want to read what you said, or is it a link?
It's kind of like four pictures. I just, from what I remember of it, I don't know if I want to navigate away from this page. So I'll just tell you what I remember of it. I remember it was saying that the thing that jumped out at me, the thing that caught my attention was that there was for pedophiles, and it was called a pedosexual. And then there was a picture side by side of that of like a white male and a child, and he was holding her up in the air, a little girl, like trying to make it seem like, you know, this behavior is okay, and trying to present an image that is, I guess you could say, it could be interpreted as a positive image, just to normalize this. And then there was something else defending it, saying, I mentioned this yesterday, that if that there are people who like children, who are attracted to children or something like that, deal with it. And I can't remember what the fourth image was, but it was like four images. But it should be on your Facebook page. Maybe I can post it again or just direct your attention to it later. But I want to say also thank you for just having us to not, I guess, use metaphors on this broadcast. It's very, very difficult, but I'm grateful for it because it shows me how dependent I am on metaphors, and it helps me not to do that. But I wanted to say, as far as the clips are concerned, and I think I listened to all of them, I listened to where, I remember I guess it was the psychologist and someone else, they were talking. And the psychologist was talking to someone else, and they were talking about these racist situations where, you know, people are coming up to people at pools and saying, or racists are coming up to victims at pools and saying, you know, did you bathe before you got in there, and this, that, and the other. And the psychologist kept stressing that it wasn't criminal. Well, it is criminal because it's harassment. And saying that it was hate, which it was not. It's racism. Racism is not about hate at all. It's about domination. And it was only playing the victim of this crime that they keep saying is not a crime. They were only playing her portion and what she was saying and her yelling and cursing at him, not playing what he was saying and not playing his harassment, not the terrorists. And going on to another clip, when they were talking about Serena Williams, I think it was about her, you know, being tested. And I believe one of the black victims said that was talking about this situation is that we're all racist and recovering racist. VGQ to them, however, that is incorrect. We are not. We are all victims or racist, not racist or recovering racist. Also, the person who was making that speech about, I want to say, Gus, what's his last name? Tory or something? Mr. Tory, who was saying thug and all that?
Correct. He's the current mayor in Toronto.
Okay, yeah. I would say definitely VGQ to him, but I think that he thought, because I figure otherwise he wouldn't be doing what he was doing, that he really thought that he was doing something of extreme value. And I think that he was just emoting and that the white people were laughing at him, that white people, whoever heard his speech, were just laughing at him because they don't care. And he's talking to this man as though, this racist, as though he cares, and he doesn't at all. And so I guess I would say that I guess recommend that. And it reminds me of how you talked about how racists, they just don't care about how they treat us. And he just was pouring his heart. He was, I don't know if that's a metaphor. He was really sharing deeply how he felt and being, you know, very passionate about how he felt. And, you know, racists don't, they just don't care about any of that. As far as Emmett Till, I noticed the language that they said that his mother demanded a public funeral. She didn't demand anything. She said that this is what it's going to be. It's up to her, you know, what things, how things are going to go. She doesn't have to demand anything. She just, you know, can say, okay, this is, we're going to do this. That's like saying she demanded that his body be cleaned or something. No, she just, it just, it was a public funeral. It is what it is. And they were, I don't know if that's a metaphor, and they were saying that to demonize her and to berate her for what she did, because they don't like that exposure. So they found a way to make it seem like she did something incorrect by having his funeral be public. As far as these farming tools, they were not specific about that intentionally, as you pointed out. It's like, what farming tools? A hammer? What did they do? You know, it would show the savagery if they mentioned what the tools are. And I'm almost done. And I noticed that they kept on stressing that it was decades old, almost like it doesn't matter. And talking about how it's so difficult to, after all this time, to get any type of prosecutions or anything like that. No, it isn't. They can do whatever it is that they want. And then they're talking about, you know, there needs to be healing and this, that, and the other. That's the reason to prosecute this case after all this time. No, there's no healing with the killers dead. And I noticed that they were stressing that, and one person also said that they were former defendants. Well, no, they weren't former defendants. They were the killers. And the last thing that I want to say is that with the mortality rates, didn't they mention Gus infant mortality rates? Not just the mothers dying, but the infants as well.
Well, the clip today was about infant mortality rates.
Okay, so it was about the infants dying, correct?
Right.
Okay, yeah, they're trying to say that, you know, that our infants are dying more. They're lying about that. I already debunked that when I thought I was debunking something else, that I showed the proof that that's just a lie. However, the person in the clip said that that situation and what they were doing, and with the lady teaching them about sleep, safe sleep, that she wasn't blaming the parents. And I don't think that she was, but I do think that in the clip with them continuously stressing that aspect of it, because the racism aspect and all of that was very, it was very much minimized, but it was just this heavy concentration on the sleep aspect of it in order to just minimize the racism and blame it on the parents. That's exactly what the point of the clip was, even if that wasn't the point of the lady who was teaching the safe sleep. And that's all I had. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Thanks, Ivy. If there are other folks who have a hand up that we have not heard from, your line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Mr. Steele.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele. I'm reporting from Pomona, California. And I wanted to say you know, that was a really nice KRS-One bumper. I really do appreciate anytime you throw in some extra flavor in there. So that was a really good song. I really did appreciate that. And I wanted to say that I've been noticing something that has, I guess, put a smile on my face, but has raised some concern on my end. I'm noticing more and more videos of victims defending themselves against racists and other, I guess, victims of racism that are exhibiting anti-black behavior. And I think that this is represents a somewhat positive development, but I have to caution you know, any victims of racism, any black people that are going to go this route in public, that anytime you're going to use physical force to defend yourself, you have to establish that you are being threatened, and then it's advisable that you stop using force once the threat appears to have been neutralized or is put in a state that that they can be apprehended by law enforcement after you call them. You have to call law enforcement. You have to establish that you were threatened, and you have to set the narrative for what is going on in that instance when you're defending yourself. If you notice the victims of racism, if you notice the perpetrators of racism and people who are behaving in anti-black matters, they oftentimes will utilize force and then call law enforcement to give their narrative of why they use force. Study the case of George Zimmerman and how he basically set up a scenario under which he would be permitted to kill Trayvon Martin, and they would be able to make it so that it appeared to be legal. Also, with that said, one of the things that I think we need to begin to stop deluding ourselves about is we need to stop pretending that there is some sort of legal procedure that will get black people justice within this legal paradigm. What I'm saying is, look, there are so many arcane, esoteric, Latinized, Latin-coded legal terms that these people, I suspect, are making up on the spot. I mean, we just listened to a report where a racist is saying that what is clearly a crime is somehow non-criminal behavior, and I suspect that it's simply because that the perpetrator in this instance is a suspected white supremacist or is a white supremacist, and the victim in this case is a victim of racism, a black person. So I think that we need to stop pretending that there is some sort of legal procedure or any sort of verdict or any sort of finding that is going to validate this legal system. We just need to regard it as invalid, and we need to assume that there's going to be no justice for any black people who are victims of racism in this system. So just proceed from there and, you know, act accordingly. And then also I wanted to say, in Chicago, there's a report that a victim of racism was recently gunned down, shot in the back by CPD. They're saying that this took place in Southside Chicago, and local reports are saying that it's an elderly gentleman, a barber who goes by the name of Snoop the Barber. And I guess I just want to say justice for Snoop the Barber. And then one last thing, there's a fake news alert. There's a news report going around that saying that the French Spider-Man personality that was in the news the other month that he is had his citizenship revoked, and that the whole affair where he saved a child from a building, that was staged, and that everybody involved in the staging, they've been arrested and they're going to be deported as well. That is a fake news report. I'm seeing that story being rapidly shared across Facebook at the very least. And I just want to say that's a fake news report. Do your own research and provide any sort of constructive information to victims that may be that may fall prey to this fake news story. And also, when you share fake news stories and all these old links to old videos, oftentimes that these links contain malicious code that can get on your mobile device or your personal computer go ahead and track you, go ahead and log your keystrokes, basically fish your computer and get all sorts of data that you may not want to be shared with a third party. Don't share these links. If you see people sharing these links, remind them that these links pose a threat to your digital security. And I guess that's all I'll be sharing for now. I'll go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Context of white supremacy. Deception, major tool, system of white supremacy. Other folks that we missed completely, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to all the callers and the host. This is Gio calling from Chicago, Illinois. Adding to that report, on the south side of Chicago, that was a barber that was shot and killed by Chicago Police Department. Multiple times he was shot, I believe 7. Listening to the WVON Facebook report, they interviewed someone and they said the guy that they interviewed that actually saw it, witnessed it, he said that the barber was actually getting off of work and he was going on his way home, and he had a license, concealed to carry. And the police stopped him, they surrounded him, and they saw his holster, and they asked him for his permit. So there's the guy saying he reached for his permit, and that's when he was shot multiple times. The Emmett Till case of being reopened. I went last month. Actually, I went to the museum, the African American Museum in D.C., and saw the casket. It's a pretty large building. I would think you would need to have like a private screen, because it probably would take you about 3 to 4 hours to go through that building. And it was pretty eerie, the whole looking at the casket, and that was a very eerie feeling. With the prosecutor that said something about made terroristic acts, threats to, I would say they were terroristic threats to Maxine Waters. I think by looking at Wikipedia, that probably would be under a hate crime by reading the definition, because it says it's a law intended to deter bias-motivated violence. Hate crime laws are distinct from laws against hate speech. Hate crimes laws enhance the penalties associated with the conduct
which is already criminal under the laws, while hate speech laws criminalize category of speech. Hate speech laws exist in many countries. In the United States, hate crime laws have been upheld by both the Supreme Court and lower courts, especially in the case of fighting words, which one of the victims said, and other violent speech. So I would think that would be under hate crimes from what I'm reading, but we'll see how that whole thing goes. And the pedophilia. I was watching a web series. I think it still comes on. It's called The Dark Web, and they practice pedophilia everywhere, as we know, looking at the news in Haiti and places like that. They were talking specifically about the Philippines, where in the web. On the internet, they have some type of dark web where people go on and they pay for children to have sex with. And this is looked upon, and the families in the Philippines that do it, they agree to it because the areas that they do it in is a poor area. And right now, the actual mayor is trying to fight against that, and they're trying to make laws to actually stop that as we speak. So this thing is practiced worldwide. And also, they're actually doing this on television. Not to say, I don't watch television like that, but a friend of mine was watching a television episode, Handmaid Tales, where they talk about a number of things. They show pedophilia. They're showing other cases of white supremacy, slavery, with predominantly white people, showing it real confusing. Genetic annihilation also. And it's so they're doing this on television. I think they're just trying to introduce people to get people comfortable with it and probably create a law for it where it's upheld. Those were some of the things I talked about. This is probably my 5 minutes, and I will mute my nine. Thank you.
Much obliged, our caller in Chicago, Gio. Thank you for the commentary. If we have other folks who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Do you want me to go?
Let's see. Well, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. This is Henry, also from Chicago, and I want to also say that in regards to the other caller, Gio, there was a report on VON in regards to the black male who was shot by the Chicago police barber. So, another black male being shot by Chicago police once again, just like the others in particular, standard operating procedures. But I also wanted to comment on the clip tying this into Chicago, the clip that you played in regards to the person commenting on the Toronto shootings and the mayor demonizing the black community. And that has been something that has been here in Chicago for decades in regards to, black people getting shot here in Chicago, and how we as confused people, fall into that, or, agree to, blaming a lot of us in regards to the shooting. But I want to reference something in regards to a report, and this is 2 years in a row. So 2016, 70% of the shootings in Chicago went unsolved. And a couple of months ago, I read in 2017, another year of 70% of shootings unsolved. So if these are black people that are doing these shootings, why are most of the jails filled with people on nonviolent offenses? I mean, we should basically have a lot of black people in jail for murders, but that's not the case. So that's something in Chicago that is happening in probably a lot of major cities where a lot of non-white black people reside. And in regards to the question in regards to keeping white women from holding your baby, it's from my experience that my child was a baby. I would have more people ask to hold her, this both white and non-white people, when I was pushing her in the cart or, you know, in a carriage. It is less likely that, you know, they would ask to hold her if you're holding the baby. But even in a case of, say, you know, they still want to hold her, even if you're holding her, just, you know, tell them that your baby has a skin condition and you don't want people, you know, holding the baby. So just to make them go away. So that's all I have on me in my life.
Much obliged. Skin condition. How about that? Appreciate that from our parents. Thank you for that reminder. If we have parents, attempted parents listening in, if you have suggestions for how you would respond to a suspected racist, especially white women, asking to look at or hold or touch your child, fondle even, if you have thoughts, suggestions, please share. The caller at 2045, did you have commentary? 2045. Last four digits, 2045. Did you have commentary or are you just listening?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Sir, greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers, listeners. As far as the baby, no. No, you can't touch the baby. Sorry. But Gio made some great points. Great calls. Great. Me and you have a bone to pick as well, though, because last week. Okay. And that's what I'm talking about, metaphor. Okay, you're right. You got me. But when I told you last week that our house is burning, that the houses are burning, you said that you were really, you was harsh on me. You said if I cannot articulate my thoughts without using metaphors, I need to maybe do some self-inventory. But literally, the house is burning. The houses are burning. And you even played a clip last week that said when the sister moved into or the melanated lady moved into that neighborhood and I think it was California, and they was throwing Molotov cocktail bombs and everything. They were trying to burn her house down. So it was not a metaphor. It's actually happening. The house is burning, Gus, and I want you to please address that for me, please. Was that a metaphor or is that the truth?
Well, it is still a metaphor because you weren't talking about her house specifically. You didn't have, unless I'm in error, you didn't have a specific house in mind. That's what I mean about being specific. That can be stated if you want to say that there is an immense problem with regards to what black people are facing in the U.S. that requires urgent action. You can say that without there being a metaphor where now I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about because it's not specific. We're not being literal. We're not being precise. And that's what I'm saying is a major part of the problem. And it just further makes my point. I get to spark. Well, it further makes my point that you began your commentary with another metaphor. And I just keep saying we're not being precise when we discuss this problem. My memory is so nice today. I can go all the way back. You were the same caller that was talking about brother. That's the same thing that I say with that. We're not being precise with words. We're just saying things because it sounds good, or we're saying things because we're emotional. We're saying things because we're angry. I understand all of that. What I'm saying is that angry, upset, happy, whatever the emotion is, we still got to be precise, strategic with the use of words. And that is probably going to require discontinuing the way that we have been talking about racism, most of us, it's going to require massive
changes to the way we talk about racism, probably we're going to have to slow down and really think, is this the most effective, is this the most precise, the most accurate way to convey my thoughts, what I want to say about racism? Does that make sense?
Man, I can't stand you, Gus, but I love
you. We was brothers last week.
I'm going to get you one day. I'm going to get you one day, Gus. Peace and love, yo. Thank you for taking my call, brother. Oh, what up, brother? My man.
Yes, sir. Context of white supremacy. If Gus is not being logical, make sure that you ask a question or say something. Alert us to that, because I make mistakes myself and I am still learning. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, questions, we have parents for sure. You should definitely respond to the question that was asked. Other folks that we've not heard from at all.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greeting callers, listeners, and Gus. Definitely a little tough to hear a lot of the news updates. A lot of it seems to be centered around children, and it's really disheartening when they do that to our offspring, and when we have to deal with it on that level. First off, I'm curious as to anybody else's reasoning as to, other than what was said by the commentary about Emmett Till, is that I believe that definitely this regime is trying to mask some of their racist behavior by actually reopening the case. And I believe it's the same thing with Muhammad Ali, as far as throwing it out and allowing him to have some kind of dignity after he's dead and gone. I believe it's the same process. Again, I like to hear other people's comments on that as well. But also on Ken Steele, he made a really, really important point, and I think it's something that will help us in our code in countering racism, is we have to be very honest with ourselves about the fact that this system is not designed and set up to help us in any form or fashion. So looking for justice within the system that's inherently corrupt and divided makes no sense logically. It just doesn't add up. And I really appreciate that comment, because that's something I've been speaking about with friends that are lawyers, and it just doesn't pan out. As far as parenting, I am a father, and I both my sons, one is from, it was what as what would be called a tragic arrangement. I'm no longer with that parent, but during the time frame where we were together, and I would be out with one of my sons that was so-called interracial, white women, and I live in Brooklyn, New York, I would go to areas that are so-called liberal areas like Park Slope, and white women especially would feel very comfortable coming up to my child and trying to pet him on the head. Literally just walking past him, seeing him, and his older brother is with him, who is taller, obviously, can deal with situations like that, but has no bearing and understanding of it to my level. He would see it and kind of just shrug, but white woman would constantly come up to him and pet him on the head and try to rub his head to touch his hair, because they felt like it was so exotic or unique, like he was a pet. And I would have to address them immediately. And I say this to the person that wrote in, don't feel any shame in putting these people in their place as far as letting them know how you feel about it, because it is your child, ultimately your offspring. I would come up to them and immediately I would address them and just say, please do not touch my child's head like that. If I touched your child's head, you would feel complete disregard or be upset with me in regards to this. Please do not touch my child's head. Of course, they'd feel frightened and threatened. I'm a darker skinned black male. I'm tall. So they back off a little bit, give an uncomfortable laugh or a smile and say, I'm sorry. But it's better to do that than to have your child be subject to that type of behavior. from white women already before my child was even turning five. So I say to that person that wrote in, please don't feel any shame. Stand firm. And when I say that, I mean, be direct and be blunt with them. You don't have to placate or make them feel comfortable and minimize your pain when you see things like that happen. That being said, that's pretty much everything I had to say. I appreciate your time and energy, guys. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, much obliged. Context of white supremacy. If we have other folks, let me give the number out one more time. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hey, how you doing, Gus? This is Victim from out of New Jersey. Gus, you know what? Like the caller that called as far as like using metaphors, in my everyday speech, I find myself using it. And I can honestly say with me talking to, because I'm still learning. As Millie Fuller would say. But for those that I come across that I can say that's more confused than me, I don't come across as clear and precise, and it takes a lot of time, how can I say, trying to get through to them or trying to get a point across. So I took that into practice, what you say, as far as like speaking directly, no metaphors, trying to use the English language to the best of my ability, because I do speak with a slang. You know, I do. You know, I don't speak. I don't speak very good English. You know, I mean, I speak good enough. So it's an everyday struggle, but in my speech, when I'm speaking to other victims, I try to speak as clear as possible, especially when I'm using, if I'm trying to explain, how can I say, even explain like Millie Fuller's or Francis Crutch Wilson or other scholars. Try to basically use their ideology. So I basically want to use them as a reference. And I want to speak as clear as possible. So I say that to say this. I definitely agree with you when using metaphors. And other victims use metaphors when they're talking to me. And you're right. They use metaphors that's not comparable to anything that we're really talking about. So I catch myself when I'm using a metaphor, and I also correct them when they're using metaphors that has nothing to do with the subject matter. The Emmett Till, opening the Emmett Till case. I'm just going to keep my eyes open. I don't know what this is really about. I mean, I don't really know if we can consider the Attorney General a suspected racist. I mean, from his actions, I can call him a racist. What I wanted to ask the callers and also you, Gus, the constant videos of victims being kicked out of swimming pools or being harassed for cutting grass. I'm just kind of wondering how constructive is this? I mean, is this working in our favor? Does this further add to our victimization, meaning making us look weak? You know, is it, you know what I mean? Does it has a, Is it a knock on our morale as a people, constantly seeing black folks kicked out of swimming pools, even though a lot of these people have been reprimanded, meaning, you know, lost jobs or, say, social media ridicule. But the overall effect, just like with the Papa John's pizza guy, it's like, you know, they're willing to face the consequences, but just to use the N-word, as they say, or just to insult victims, you know, just, you know, it seems like, I think that they know what they're doing, and once the message gets out, the damage is already done. So I'm just not sure by victims constantly recording these acts. Are they trying to show the world to say, look, listen, look, they're racist, racism exists? So I'm really not sure what the message is. Like, what are we doing here? Like, is it causing more damage than good by all these recordings?
That's 5 minutes. If we could pause there.
Go ahead.
No apology needed. Just if you can hold on a second, or if you could wait a few minutes probably, and once we can get everybody get at least one opportunity to speak, if you have another question or comment, we can get your additional thoughts. People can answer his question as we move through the callers. I will just say quickly, I think a knock on our morale, I think that might be a metaphor. Does it make us look weak talking about these videos? I've concluded in a system of white supremacy, we are weak. So it would not take much to show the truth, that which is, regarding black people being weak, especially relative to whites. So I think that's pretty much on display on a regular basis. That is true. Other folks that have dialed in, if you have commentary, if questions, if you want to respond to any of the questions that have been posed, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you, line should be open. Proceed. I know some of the folks who do have a hand up, my switchboard button is sticking where I'm pressing the button where it's not functioning properly, but I'm pressing the button and I'm thinking that the line is open and then it's not opening. So at least for a few people, if you can hang on what should be, I hope, a few seconds, and we'll see if the switchboard decides to work correctly. Let's try it again and see if the button, if the line opens. Yes, okay, working correctly now. So some of the other folks who dialed in with the hand up more recently, if we've not heard from you, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, heard everyone. Let's see. We'll get, is that retired firefighter?
Yes, sir.
Proceed.
Greetings, everyone. How was the question framed about the touching of your child?
Oh, she wrote, lots of white women, but white people in general, what would you do to stop whites if they're coming to ask to look at your child or hold your child, touch your child, younger child? What would you do to stop that without creating any new problems?
I take a similar position that a previous caller did. You speak directly to the subject. Specifically, I don't want you touching my child. And if the person asks the question on why, then I would tell them directly. I don't want my child familiar in that way with white people. We are living under a global system of racist white supremacy. And, you know, just go from there. You know, as long as that person want to talk, if you have the time, if they have the time, you can find it good, you know, as far as they're concerned. Ultimately, by you asking questions, they would eventually would leave that subject alone. And you put, I would put an asterisk on it, unless it's an emergency professional. I expect them to do their job, you know, whether it's a doctor or a firefighter, you know, that sort of thing. And if they don't, you know, you can't control that anyway, one way or the other. But I would explain all that to if it goes, you know, into a conversation, I explain all that to that white person, male or female. More than likely, it would be a female, of course. And I would say also, because white people understand this better than we do, and white women especially do understand that they, due to the system of racial white supremacy, they understand that they get undeserved acknowledgement. They have been since the establishment of racial white supremacy, but I would say in this particular case, it'll be okay to basically, you know, just basically tell that person, that white person, exactly what you think about the matter. DCF system, mentoring system, today had their final address to the group of young fellows. Black males had that session today. I would say that something of that nature, although I myself, someone questioned me about being a mentor, and I did admit that I actually don't think of myself as a mentor, and I gave the reason because of to be a mentor, you have to be a perfect person, but I do take the position, same position of the organization itself, and, you know, to deal directly with other males who happen to be, you know, in this case, younger than I am. Heck, I need to be a member of the situation myself in a lot of cases, as far as that concerned. But anyway, it's certainly needed. I've had another young black male who I coached who was murdered a few days ago. So something like that is certainly needed. There's a long line of young black males that I have coached who actually suffered from getting killed by other black males. So it certainly is needed in this confused state that we find ourselves in the global system of racial white supremacy. And that's all I have to say right now. Thank you.
My condolences, retired firefighter. That is the system of white supremacy worldwide, designed deliberately to produce black people being killed, murdered in large numbers all over the planet, and to try strategically as frequently as possible to have it so that it is black people killing other black people, non-white people killing other non-white people as often as possible. That is strict racist design. But my condolences.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
For you and the family of the victim and other folks on the team for having to experience that. That is what we are trying to solve. The caller who dialed in last four digits. Switchboard. The caller who dialed in last four digits 2812. Did you have commentary? 2812.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. Call from Virginia. I'll be brief. The first thing was the Emmett Till clip. There is a pattern, and I think it goes back to something that Mr. Fuller says. White people do what they want when they want, and them bringing this up is just another, just another way that they just think of black people in a very lowly state, because I could be wrong, but there are a lot of other black people, non-white people across the planet that are in need of justice now. And it's nothing against Mr. Till or his family, but the fact that they consistently bring up this case as something that they need to, quote unquote, bring healing or to bring justice is almost as an insult. I'm pretty sure that there are other specifically black people that have documented cases of injustice that they could compensate or do something about, and they still choose to do nothing about it. One other thing I wanted to mention, I've done a lot of traveling over the last couple of months. Also, one of the gentlemen previously had mentioned going to the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., and I always like to point out for people who go there, it is extremely traumatic, and I believe, regardless of what anyone says that is a victim, and just my personal opinion, white people set it up to be that way. The Emmett Till exhibit is, when I went there in January, the line was 3 hours long. And one of the questions I asked the individual I was with was, why is it constructive to see this casket? And why are there so many white people standing in line to see this casket as well? Just a thought. Two places I did visit. I visited the museum in Atlanta. I think it's for human rights. And there are two things that I noticed immediately. When you first walk into the museum on the first floor, they have four white men there, and they have a sign over their names that says segregationists. They had a suggestion box, and I said, I think it would be more accurate to label these men white supremacists when you walk in. When I said that and I gave the card to the woman that at the membership desk, she said, I never thought of it like that. The second thing was I visited Savannah, Georgia. I liked the town. I had a interesting time when I was there. There was the first Black Baptist church in that particular area. I think it's important that if victims are in that particular area, I think it's pretty constructive if you can visit there. That church, how it was explained by the black male that gave the tour, was actually built by former slaves who, after they got off the plantation, they spent their time and energy building this particular church in the early 1800s because they did not like the way that the white man was worshiping. I also asked him, have there been any images of European or white males in here, such as white Jesus, quote unquote, they say, and he says never. It's always been an Afrocentric church, and it has a huge Gullah ancestry in that church, and possibly might have been a site for the Underground Railroad, as documented. So I think it's in Savannah, Georgia, and I think that was pretty constructive. And the last place that I visited, I'm not going to give the restaurant any press because I don't suggest any victims visit it. But it is sort of a restaurant style to where you visit this restaurant and it is I guess everyone sits around a table. And I was wondering why the reviews and why the line was so long. And basically you have to wait an hour to even get into this restaurant. It's tons of victims and white people, just all sorts of people visiting this restaurant. And while I'm standing online outside with another individual waiting, a black male comes outside in an apron and starts yelling and screaming and saying, is everybody ready for fried chicken? And he immediately goes back inside. And when you sit down in this restaurant, everyone, all the white people, I can understand why they love it, because it's all based upon black service and black subservience. I don't even think I said that word right, Gus, but just based upon black people just being servants to anyone that walks in that establishment. So I'll continue to give some compensatory reports, and I hope I didn't go over my time, and I appreciate everybody on the call. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged. Fried chicken. I'm trying to remember the line from The Help, Octavia Spencer, when she's cooking fried chicken with the suspected racist white woman. And she said, fried chicken just makes, it's something like fried chicken just makes your soul feel good or something to that effect. That's a metaphor too. But yes, fried chicken makes the world go round. Metaphor, I know. Words are extraordinarily important. I'm so glad to hear about your suggestion at the center in Atlanta. I don't think you said the King Center. I think you were talking about the other museum that they have that I think is affiliated with the King Center, but that is spectacular suggestion. Segregationist, what does that even mean? white supremacist. Be accurate with the use of words. Great job. Great suggestion. Other folks that we've missed completely, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you at all, you should go ahead and speak now.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Codified Software Developer, Wisconsin.
Hi. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers and listeners. Am I breaking up, Gus? I listened to the Neutralizing Workplace Racism broadcast, and it sounded like I was breaking up a bit. So am I breaking up now?
You sound okay now. I guess if you want to talk a little bit more, we'll listen. But, yeah, you sound okay.
Okay. Just making sure. Thank you. To the mother who asked the question of what should she do when white females in particular are asking to touch or look at her child, I'm a mother as well, and someone much wiser than me once told me that no was a complete sentence and that I didn't need to give any explanations when I said no. So I would just say no, and that would be it. And that's something that I practice regularly with white people, just saying no, not giving any explanations. I think that we've been conditioned to give explanations to white people, to have to explain ourselves to white people, our actions. And we don't have to do that as victims of racism. We don't have to do that. No is a complete sentence. And that's what I would say. Regarding some things that I've had happen to me. I've had a couple of racist incidents happen to me. I guess I'll call this sort of vignettes while smoking. And I think the creator is trying to tell me that perhaps I should quit. So I was at a library in a predominantly black area of Milwaukee, and there was a white male, younger white male that was outside of the library, and I was standing outside, was getting ready to go in, and I was smoking. And he came up to me, and he asked me for a cigarette, and I said no. And I kept walking, and he said, oh, I sure did want one. And I just didn't look at him. I didn't pay any attention to him, and he followed me to the door of this library watching me. I suspect that he was very confused by my behavior, I'm pretty sure, in a predominantly black area. There are black people who will willingly give him a cigarette, but I do not help white people. And in fact, I think that white people who come into predominantly black areas asking for things are race soldiers. They mm-hmm. know that there are a limited amount of resources afforded to the people in those areas, and they are coming to get those resources. So I consider that an act of racism. Keeping in line with that, I was at my AA meeting, and there was a white male that came in. He looked like an opioid addict, which is not necessarily it's not necessarily uncommon for an AA meeting, so I didn't really pay attention to him. However, he was going from black person to black person, speaking to them very urgently. I went outside after the meeting, and again, I was smoking. He came outside, and he asked me for a cigarette, and again, I said no. He then went into this long story about how he was stranded from Green Bay. He had come to Summerfest, which is this huge music festival that happens around this time every year in Milwaukee, and he was stranded. And I asked him, I said, well, you don't have any family or friends here? And he said, no, he just needed some bus fare. And I said, and I walked inside. I didn't give him anything. Again, he's going from person to person. I noticed that one of the black females who's very white identified, older black female, about 60 years old, very white identified, was digging in her purse, ready to hand this race soldier some money. The last incident was July 4th. I had to go to Sam's Club with my mother to get some stuff for our family reunion. And I walk in with my mother, and there's this. Now, I don't know if she was white or non-white. It was a female. I don't know if she was white or non-white. She was racially ambiguous, so I classified her as white. And she said something to me. She had a very strong accent, so I just sort of nodded and kept going. She then came up to me further on in the warehouse store and touched my arm. And at that point, I said, do not touch me. And she said, oh, I just wanted a cigarette. My husband doesn't let me smoke. And I said, I don't have any, and kept going. I saw her in various places around the store. It appeared that she was following me. And she didn't have a cart. She didn't have even a purse. And it just seemed like she would just show up in these various places. This is a large warehouse store, so it was very odd that I would see her multiple times while I was there. So those are three acts of terrorism that I've experienced while smoking. Again, I think the creator is trying to tell me to quit, and maybe I'll take that suggestion. With that, I'll mute my line. Thanks so much for listening.
Much obliged for sharing. Call in Wisconsin. I'm reminded I posted on our social media sites the broadcast we did 2016. Dr. Valerie Yerger, menthol cigarettes and melanin. She's a black professor. Lots of constructive information that she researches white supremacy, cigarettes, and black health. That program, she gave a lot of great information, again, talking about deliberate strategic acts to make sure that black people are cigarette smokers and long-term cigarette smokers to drive up those cancer rates and everything else. So absolutely, that with all of your brilliance in the software world and expertise, definitely let's preserve your health as best you can and see if you can let go of those cigarettes. But that white's coming up with that level of familiarity as a precursor to terrorism, that is very common. I would encourage folks to be very alert about that. White's coming up and just touching you, even if it's, you know, ostensibly, oh, hey, I thought I recognized you, or, oh, can I get a cigarette, or can I, you know, do you have any spare change, or whatever it is, be very alert, be very mindful about that, and I would step back immediately, be very guarded about your personal space out in public. I hate that, because I deal with that a lot as well with whites here. They will come up with this familiarity as though we're friends, as though I know this person. They generally will not touch me. But they will get very close, and the smiling and talking as though they already know me. And I move away immediately. Like, if I don't recognize you and, you know, what's your name, that sort of thing, immediate, just lots of caution. Whites are so, so dangerous in all of those situations. This white woman following you, and you said the white guy looked like he was following you to the door and everything. Like, just whites are extremely dangerous. If you don't know them, exercise maximum caution. Distance, just be really, really alert. Other folks, if we've not heard from you at all, if you have a hand up, you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace, Gus, and peace to all of the call listeners tonight. This is V from Central New York. I will tell you, I was working through most of the broadcast. And the clips that you selected were, wow, they synchronized wonderfully with a project that I'm working on presently. So thank you very much for the inspiration. Some notes that I took, first and foremost, on pedophilia. About 15 years ago, I was reading an article on a website, which obviously, you know, I cannot even recall now. But it was before I became really conscious or aware of racism and could not only quantify it, but describe it in a way that I could understand it. And this person, I remember they quoted both Neely Fuller and I think, it was one of the members of the Black Panthers, but I can't remember which one. And with Neely Fuller, they mentioned that he had said black men would be wearing dresses or would become feminized. And then the member of the Black Panthers suggested that the movement towards offering homosexuals a broader rights in society, whether true or not, seemed to be the first step, his words, not mine, in opening the door for pedophilia. His argument primarily was that white people were very asexual and homosexuality was not abnormal in European culture. It was actually the norm to be non-homosexual was abnormal, and that pedophilia was also similarly practiced throughout the entire European and white population. So he wondered if that would be basically an invitation to pedophilia. That, I think, I'm hoping I'm incorrect in this, but I wonder sometimes if we are not, if we are moving somewhat in that direction, as people are describing it more and talking about it. I'm wondering if in the 2020s, we are going to stop wondering if we should ban it. And if people will start saying, well, maybe under certain circumstances, we need to just say, because it's been going on, that we need to legalize it. I'm concerned about that because it is so prevalent. Beyond that, the infant mortality rates. I found a very good Marimba Ani video that was just posted, I think, over the last year on YouTube, which she was talking about the organizational practices of Africa, which needed to be implemented in the Black population in America for specifically, not alone, but specifically these problems, that we are a very group-oriented people, and there were structures set up in Africa to ensure that when a baby was born, they were taken through the rearing process in a healthy way that allowed their mind and their intellect to develop fully. And while I do cast aspersion and doubt on the figures that are now being touted about Black mothers and Black infant death, I do think we as a Black population need to start looking and studying more into the African way of rearing children, because that will help us fight racism, white supremacy. And finally, the DOJ, Department of Justice, never forget, it was the FBI technically, but the DOJ lent its credibility to it. They released the memo on Black identity extremists to law enforcement. And the Supreme Court in the last year has ruled several times legalizing gerrymandering throughout this country. It is believed, it has been written by several judicial scholars, that more rulings will be coming over the coming 2 years that will make it very difficult for Black people in this country to vote. So the fact that they're going back to Emmett Till and not going back to the 1980s when drug trafficking was done legally into our community to shatter it tells you that this is just a way of covering over what they're doing. Thank you very much. And Gus, thank you as always. Have a good night.
Much obliged, sir. Keep up the work, constructive work on your project. Red in Nevada, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes, thank you for allowing me to share. Hello, everyone, and write poorly. I didn't get a chance to, I wasn't able to listen to the clips, so I'm not sure if the story about the Black Mississippi farmers was spoken about. Was it spoken about, or did you include one of those clips, Gus? Because I don't want to.
It was not. It was not included.
Okay, I'll just be really quick with my three things. This is one of the three. The article came out. There's an article on Atlanta Black Star, and it came out on July 11th. It says Black Memphis farmers were deliberately sold bad seeds in scheme to put them out of business. And just the basically along the short version of it, there's a small group of Black farmers. Of course, as we know, that there are not that many Black farmers. I know a while back on the cows, there was a segment that was played about another Black farmer whose farm was taken away. And I know it definitely resonated with me. But these Black farmers, they bought seeds from a company called Stein Seeds. And I really like how the Black farmers, they did they didn't necessarily bring up racism, white supremacy, but they brought up discrimination. One of them, last name Burrell, he said Mother Nature does not discriminate. It doesn't rain on white farms, but not black farms. Insects don't only attack black farmers' land. Why is it that when white farmers buy Stein seeds and their yield is 60 to 100 bushels per soybeans, these are talking about soybeans, and black farmers who are using the exact same equipment with the exact same land, all of a sudden your seeds are 5, 6, or 7 bushels, which is less than, you know, that's 10% of the white farmers, which I definitely appreciated that segment, our sentiment rather. They did get their seeds tested by the Mississippi State University and found that the seeds were actually bad seeds. They said that the samples showed rotten, molded seeds. And of course, with this racist company, one of the statements that they put out was that, you know, they take the allegations seriously, you know, the same exact talking points. White supremacists, they don't have to change anything. They literally, I feel like they have one same statement that they use, and they just basically change the company name, the person's name, just it's the same. But anyways, they basically said it was meritless and it was not factual. So despite, I'm assuming that Mississippi University is a white university. I'm sure it is. But they don't even care about, you know, the seeds being tested. So I thought that was, you know, definitely disheartening, especially with the fact that some of the farmers said they spent almost $100,000 on these seeds because they're supposed to be really good. The other thing was just a quick note about the opioid epidemic. There is a small faction of white people who are saying that they, who are actually taking the medication, who feel that they are not junkies, are saying that they are now being affected by these stringent drug laws. And one of the article in the Washington Post from the 14th says, amid the opioid crisis, some seriously ill people risk losing drugs they depend on. And, you know, just basically what I said, just white people kind of saying that they're being affected by the junkies of their race. I apologize, the drug addicts of their race. And at the end of the article, it basically talks about how there's a study. It's the University of North Carolina School of Medicine is a part of a $9 million study considering how cognitive behavioral therapy and motivational interviewing, helping patients figure out how to achieve their goals, might help reduce the use of opioids. And it made me, that article also made me think about just what Gus was talking about with the Black professor. When she came on the show, and that was one of the first shows that I listened to on the COWS, when she was talking about the cigarettes, the menthol cigarettes, they kind of attach themselves to melanin. And I remember sharing this information with victims, Black victims who I know smoke, especially smoke menthol cigarettes, and how she said that she wasn't able to get, you know, really the funding. And it just, you know, really just shows just how even in a course like in academia that they can put money towards funding that would better them. But if it's to help Black people, of course, they never have the money. The other thing was that just the issues that I know I have in my personal life with white women, and I try to not let it get to me, and trying to just read, you know, the code and just try to develop my own code, of course. But I know I also have an issue with white racist women, like if they, you know, they kind of walk in front of you and they see that you can't, and they, I guess, like with me, I always have like this angry face, or I don't know, I don't have a pleasant face most of the time. They then want to smile at you and take up your time by bringing up needless conversation. That's happened to me. And then also there was one white woman, I actually got ID'd at one location where I was at, and there was a white woman not that far away from me, and she said, because I was ID, because I looked young, and the white woman was like, well, you know, say thank you. And I basically gave her like almost like this disgusted smile, if that's such a thing. And she didn't say anything else to me for that moment that I was around her. So I definitely understand everyone else's sentiment with white women. They like to take up your time, and I feel like they definitely know their position on, you know, on this worldwide plantation. So I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Deliberately sabotaging the black farmers. Much obliged, Red in Nevada. The caller, last four digits. Ooh, I just had the number in front of me. Last four digits, 4717. 4717. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Crystal clear.
Thank you, Gus, for taking my call. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. The audio clip that mentioned these statistics regarding black babies dying at an alarming rate before age one. I don't necessarily believe that that's true data. I do believe that these statistics are present, but at a much more prevalent rate, at much more lower numbers. At a much less prevalent rate in lower numbers. But I believe that a lot of that can be attributed to medical apartheid. You know, they practice on us on a regular. They've been doing this for years. We know that. So I believe that a lot of that is contributed to medical apartheid. But just to suggest some ways, several ways that we can combat those anomalies that do speak to those statistics, I would encourage more women to take your health, especially your prenatal health, seriously, you know, mental, emotional, physical, and diet. If possible, breastfeed your babies for as long as you can, you know, during the first 2 years of their life. Similac and all the other formula companies have shown us that they cannot be trusted. They are not trustworthy by any means. You know, a couple other things, learn CPR, do research, and don't let the doctor tell you that your baby has to receive all those injections that they have immediately after your baby is born. And most importantly, have a birth plan. You know, when we come into these delivery rooms to have our babies and we're not prepared and they know that, they can do anything. They can tell us anything and have us believe it. But if you are educated and aware, you can make more informed decisions. If I could briefly share a personal experience that I had when I had my daughter, I came to the hospital with my husband, my birth plan in hand, and because I was in so much pain, my husband was explaining my birth plan to the admitting nurse, and she completely disrespected him by ignoring him and continuing to ask me questions, although I was not answering her. And he's like, you know, I didn't just meet her down in the lobby. This is my wife, and this is the plan that she has given me for you guys to follow. But until I spoke up, which was difficult because I was in so much pain, he literally almost had to argue with this lady up and down on the fact that he did not just meet me. And she can trust him with this plan that I have given him to deliver our child. So moving on, the mother that was asking the question, and oh my gosh, this is my favorite. The mother that was asking the question about the racist white woman asking to ogle her son. Oh my gosh, when you look at the definition of that word, you immediately get the sense of pedophilia in mind. And that just disgusted me. So I think she mentioned that she ignores them. One thing that I did, and I still do when my daughter was younger, and even now that she's older, when they try to compliment her hair, I just ignore them. And when they become persistent, because we all know white racist man, woman, or child hate to be ignored, I just give them a blank stare and blink several times. I may blink 5 to 7 times and just simply walk off as if I don't understand what they're saying. And they get the point that I'm not interested in anything that they have to say. And they'll eventually leave you alone because you're not responding to them. You're not giving them any attention or anything. And this is just something that I learned from observing foreign people when they act as if they don't understand English or anything that you're saying whenever you talk to them. So I've adapted that that behavior, and that's simply what I do. I just ignore them, give them several blinks while giving them a blank stare. Sometimes I may tilt my head to the side because they hate being ignored, and they may be persistent in, oh, did you hear me? Sometimes they may step in front of your cart in the grocery store and make sure that they get your attention by standing in front of your face. I just simply ignore them and walk away as if I don't even understand what they're saying. So I would suggest that, and that's very powerful because it really gets to them and it really, really bruises. It really bothers them, I would say. I'm just going to conclude my comment with that. Thanks for taking my call, Gus.
Much obliged for the suggestions. I think when I said crystal clear, I think that's a metaphor too. I'm still learning myself, as I said. Much obliged for the suggestions for the black mother who wrote in. Our caller in Florida, did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. There was a few things I wanted to make mention about. That first segment, I think, was about the black athletes. I think Serena being, tested. Maybe they say about six times or something. And when the guy, I believe these are victims of racism, who were on that segment, and they were, comparing her to the Maria, I don't know what her last name is, a white woman. And I think, if I heard it correctly, they said that she beat her like 18 times in a row or something. I don't know if I heard that correctly. Just great skill in the sport and just racist envy and jealousy of Serena Williams. And that reminded me when they started talking about Michael Vick and Barry Bonds and a lot of the other black athletes that the system of white supremacy targets. There was another program that these two black males host, and it was about 10 to 12 white people that called up practicing racism, as they call trolling. I know that could be a metaphor, but just being disruptive. And it was a white woman too. It was like a lot of white men or one white woman. And it was a lot of name calling in the particular broadcast. That reminded me of that. And the segment about, I think, the white guy who wrote the book, something about Trump Hate Unleashed, the Trump era, I think that's what it's called. Like, just using that word unleashed, I don't know why that particular word was used. And I think that was a white person that was talking. He was saying that certain incidents, that these are just incidents, not crimes, like how they get in control and sustaining control of how words are used and how these things are interpreted. And I think it was racist for him to say the term borderline when we're talking about non-white people and borders, for immigration. And then he said it again. He said, we're looking at some of these incidents and you just never know if it'll constitute as a hate crime or is borderline, and then sometimes they'll cross the line. I don't know if anybody remember hearing that part. Like, I think he was skillfully practicing white supremacy. And one last thing, it was another word that was used. I think it was for the babies. And the white woman used the term, disentangle or something like that. Like, I think she was like, I'm thinking, why use that particular word like that? Like, that seemed racist to me. Almost making it synonymous with lynching. I don't know if anybody else perceived it that way. But that's the way that I had interpreted or perceived it. And that's the only thing that I have right now, and thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller.
Can I be heard?
in Florida. I can hear you, Mr. Steele, but we have some folks that we have missed completely. I want to try and make sure I at least nab everyone once. Much obliged for your patience, Mr. Steele. The person who dialed in last four digits, 6260. Did you have a commentary? Last four digits, 6260. Did you have commentary, or are you just listening?
Oh, hi, guys. This is Jotamania. I don't have much to say, but I just wanted to say that I was listening to that actual clip that you were talking about in the archives with the young lady that was talking about her child being ogled by the white supremacist. I was literally just listening to that today. And I just thought that was kind of interesting. And I just wanted to say that it's basically, thank you for helping me to understand that in this system of white supremacy that I should not expect anything more than to be abused and mistreated. You know, that's what I should expect in the system. That's what they continue to do to us because they do not look at us as human beings. And I'll mute my line to let other people talk. And have a nice evening, everybody.
Indeed, Draptomania. Nothing that I say with pride, just trying to be truthful about the system of white supremacy, what we can expect, having realistic expectations. I've said that consistently. I think that's very important for Black mental health. Mhandisi, did you have commentary, sir? Mhandisi?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I was going to make mention of just two things. I think it was just two things. One, it's important, and we need to attack religions, or however you say, discredit them as much as you can on your social media outlets like YouTube. We need more people talking about that. The other thing is that I was watching on YouTube this channel called American Renaissance with Jared Taylor, and there's two videos in particular. One is Irreconcilable Differences, and the other one was Something Arise. Check those two out. It's talking about killing Black people, as many as they can. One of the videos was talking about in South Africa, they're preparing to kill what I heard, or maybe listen to it, they're preparing to kill all the Africans in South Africa. And they plan, according to what he said, they plan that 1/6 of the white people that are there in South Africa will survive this attack, this massacre, genocide, however you want to call it. 1/6 of the white people are supposed to survive it, according to all the simulations that they ran on, I guess, some type of computer. Those are the things I wanted to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mhandisi. We had Dr. Gedalia Braun on the program live from South Africa, no less. He is a contributor for American Renaissance. He's had articles published there. He was on to talk about some of his writings that are similar to the thinking promoted by American Renaissance, people familiar with their literature. But he was on the program, I think, 2011. And interestingly, with Dr. Gedalia Braun, with all of his white supremacist theory, he did admit to being engaged in sexual intercourse with Black people in South Africa. Or I can't even limit it to South Africa, his travels throughout the continent. And I think even on with all of that, I think he also sold brownies. I think we nabbed everybody. I think we got all the callers who had a hand up, although we did have some issues, or I had some issues with the switchboard where sometimes it would the page would just reload strangely, and sometimes I opened lines and it seemed that they didn't open immediately. So there may have been some issues, but I think we did get all of the folks who dialed in with a hand up. If we missed anyone, my apologies. It was not deliberate. I am a victim. And Mr. Steele, if you can get your comment in 20 seconds, because we are at the 3-hour mark. Did you have something that you can get in briefly? 20 seconds, Mr. Steele?
Yes.
also, in these videos where victims of racism are defending themselves, I'm noticing that a few of them are making the mistake of saying something like, I hate you Mexicans, or I'm tired of you white people, and then they are administering their defense. Try to avoid using these phrases. Even try to avoid saying any sort of national origins, because national origins are protected classes within the federal statute. So
we'll leave it there.
Opening yourself up to
much obliged. Much obliged. I do think that's a constructive recommendation, regardless. And I know in some of those situations, things can. These situations can start quickly, and so it's not like you've had a day or a week to plan your response, but as best you can, you've been saying that the entire evening, be very precise with what you say. You do not want to have it be a situation where you have been terrorized and then all of a sudden you are the one that's being talked about as though you are the perpetrator, the agitator in the situation. Racists are phenomenal at being able to do that, and most of it comes to words. Who is able to do a better job of using words to describe what happened? Words are very important. Be extremely mindful about what you are saying. With that, in fact, I can... All of the talking that I have done about my yoga classes and what have you, one thing that I did not expect, which I am appreciating greatly, in teacher training specifically, words are a huge amount of the training. So much, because most of what you do as a yoga instructor is talk. You do put your hands on, but most of the class, you are not touching anyone. You are just using words to move people around. You have to be very precise, exact with your use of words. And I had no idea. And I mean precise to the point where it's stop adding ings to your verbs. Use use specific types of verbs. Use specific adjectives when you're talking to set these poses and postures up. I had no idea the amount of time and precision we would be spending with words in the class and having people. You did not say the word your. You're supposed to say your. You never tell a person to move the leg. You never tell a class to move the leg. It's move your leg. I did not. Possessive adjectives, talk about that on the program all the time. I did not expect that level of detail to language from yoga teacher training. Major overlap with counter-racism. With that, we will conclude. We'll be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. A little bit earlier, 2:30 p.m. Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what is happening globally. System of white supremacy. We'll look forward to having some of our international listeners participate. If you have questions, complaints, gripes, looking forward to buying as much as possible from whites, racists on Amazon, feel free to nab Gus an item or two, the wish list under Gus T. Renegade. We will be here in about 13 hours for another broadcast. Thanks everyone for tuning in, participating. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Given the terrorism that we are facing, I think it would behoove us to be thinking clearly so that we can make phenomenal decisions to try to keep ourselves as safe as possible. Certainly, Dr. Welsing and many others that we esteem, they would want us to preserve our mental health as best we can. Leaving all of those poisons, toxins out of our body, I think would be great. Likewise, when we are in a motor vehicle, driver or passenger, not only do we want to be sober, buckled up every time, let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Discontinuing smoking cigarettes is a massive act of black self-respect and counter-racism. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.